Promoter throughout North America. I kick every one of their asses.
The fraud, the messing with me.
In a court of law, I took on the United States of America and I kicked her ass. I took on WCW and it took me a while, but I kicked their asses. Mr. McMahon, what's your secret? More than any one quality that makes me the successful man that I am, ruthless aggression. So I want to know here tonight, as you stand here on my ring, which one of you has that quality? Who among you has that one single ingredient? Who has enough ruthless aggression?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
North South Connection, welcome to another episode of the Ruthlessly Aggressive Podcast. We have a very special episode in store. We have a first time deal we're going to pull off here where I'm actually going to have two guests because the shows were just so good this week and just people were clamoring to cover them. So, but before we get into it and I introduce my guests, I would be it would be remiss of me not to mention the day we're recording this. The famous Pat Patterson passed away today. Obviously a wrestling legend, both in the ring and maybe honestly by this point, maybe more known for his backstage role and his creativity behind the scenes. But obviously a huge loss, just a complete legend. Responsible. I mean, you can't really overstate his influence as far as a backstage mind and how much of a role he played in WWE, basically taking over the world. So he will be missed, but I'm sure people will do many tributes to him in long form. But for now, I just want to mention that from the get-go. But let me introduce my two guests on this one. My first guest was actually on the very first episode of this podcast. He joins me on Highway to the Impact Zone on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed. And he is a perfect person for this set of shows because he is the number one Jeff Hardy fan that I know. And that is Mr. Logan Crossland. What's up, Logan?
Not too much, man. You doing all right?
Yeah, I'm good. Are you excited to, see Jeff try and make himself famous?
Oh, yeah. I can't wait to wax poetic about my boy. And I'm glad we actually get to see him in a good match for once.
Very good. And my other guest on this, like I said, first time ever, three-man booth here on the Ruthlessly Aggressive Podcast, is one of the founding fathers of the North-South feed. You can find him on a litany of podcasts, too many to list at this point. And that is Mr. JT Rosero. What's up, JT?
What's up, fellas? Excited to be here on the old Whistle Pig Express. I have a trivia question for you right out of the gate, though. Can I throw it out there?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to list some names, and I want you guys to tell me what they have in common, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You ready?
All right.
All right. Callum McDougal, Scott Shiflett, Sean Kidd, Tyler Kelly, James Grunberg, Sean Kidd, Scott Shiflett, Steve Riddle, Sean Kidd, Louis Maynard, Ben Locke. Those names ring a bell. Like, what do you see the common thread with all those guys?
All really attractive. It's the first thing that comes to mind. I don't know. All legends, I would say.
They were all guests on this podcast that warranted being the only guest with you, Jake. Big names. And I'm just sad that you didn't see me in that regard. So, I mean, I'm happy, Logan, but I understood I can't carry the show on my own like Rooney can. So I get it. I get it. Well, it's something to attain to, you know?
Well, if we could go behind the curtain for a second. So the story on this is that both of you at different points had expressed interest in this very episode because it is obviously a pretty famous episode. Logan, because he loves Jeff Hardy so much, and I think he was a young child at this point watching this show, watching this Raw, and his heart filled with joy at seeing Jeff climb that ladder. And then you, JT, were there live, correct? Yes?
I was at the Raw, yep.
Yeah. And so me, being the very organized person I am, basically invited both of you on without realizing that I had, because you had both expressed interest. And we had been planning this for a long time. And so I kind of did the sitcom inviting two dates to the...
real same... Zach Morris you pulled right there.
Yes, exactly. So you guys are kind enough to share the airtime. Nah, I mean,
at least it was Logan and not Sean or something, so I'm okay with it. It worked out. Yeah.
Sean.
Yeah, absolutely. It could have been much worse, trust me.
A real train wreck.
No. As it were, I think we'll make it work. But thank you guys for both coming on. So as we always do to start the show, I will open up with the news and notes. So I'll run through these really quick, and I'll let you guys comment on anything that catches your attention. So on the last episode, I mentioned that Bret Hart had fallen on his bicycle, but at that point it wasn't really known. Now it is confirmed he did suffer a stroke. Dave kind of goes into all the details of that. Basically, that he kind of lost feeling in the left side of his body after he hit the back of his head. He wasn't wearing a helmet, that sort of thing. He's in pretty rough shape. He is expected to make, some kind of recovery, but as of this point in time, he is really kind of unable to walk, but they do think he will be able to. So Bret's in rough shape, and obviously this would be, what would kind of, ail him for many years to come and kind of, get rid of any chance of him ever come. I mean, he does make a return, but it's kind of rough. Mm-hmm. Other than that, so continuing on, the latest business reports are out and shows that despite the downturn in business, WWE is still doing just fine financially. I usually cover on the pod, they are maybe in a little bit of a downswing, but surely they're not going broke. During the investors call, Linda McMahon blamed competition from shows such as The Osbournes, Fear Factor, SpongeBob, and Survivor as contributing to the falling ratings. All hot
that's
shows.
That's an infamous interview. Like, I remember that, those shows. As soon as you said it jogged my memory, that's what they're competing, because they purposely don't mention like any other wrestling, They always try and position themselves as competing in the entertainment business, pal. So like they're always trying to just put themselves against shows like that versus other wrestling programs. So it's funny that Linda went out and spoke that line.
Yeah, and Dave goes out of his way, because he's always got to like do this to him, but he mentions that they never are head to head with any of those shows, I think, except maybe the Osbournes, I think, is the only one. But he's like, they don't even go head to head with any of these, so why would it affect their ratings, which is kind of funny. The second NWA TNA show is in the books, and Dave says it was highlighted by an incredible four-way main event of Low Ki versus Jay Lynn versus AJ Styles versus Psychosis, that Dave said was in the 4.5-star range, so he liked it. But he does say that a lot of the stuff besides that was complete crap, basically. So he kind of shits on the rest of the show besides that match.
I also had that before.
Yes. Yes, I figured you would, because you guys have covered that on TNA Never Dies. Mm-hmm. TNA has also signed a new wrestler named Monty Brown, who's been wrestling on the indies in Michigan under the name The Alpha Male. So, Logan, I thought that would pop you, hearing that this is when Monty was signed, back in 2000.
Baby. Period.
Taping for the third season of Tough Enough has been postponed due to Kelsey Grammer, because they're trying to tape it in his neighborhood, and he is apparently not happy about it. He doesn't want...
God, this, I remember that, too. These are all pretty infamous stories. Poor Frazier. Yeah. Not happy.
Yeah. He's not happy. He does not want Tough Enough in his neighborhood, citing, worries of too much noise in the quiet neighborhood. And so... They've already spent like $100,000 on pre-production, and so this is a big controversy. If they can't work it out, they plan to film it in Stamford. Another one that we've kind of
go in there and clean them out.
Yeah.
Was Frasier still on? When did that end? I feel like that was still.
Yeah, it's one of those weird shows where you think of it as a 90s show, but I feel like it did.
04. Creep to, yeah, 93 to 04. So yeah, still going.
Yeah, I was gonna say 03, but I wasn't sure.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So maybe he's a little sour about Frasier going off the air, so he's sticking it to tough enough. As I mentioned on previous pods, it was kind of alluded to, but is now official, Diamond Dallas Page's in-ring career is officially over after his insurance company basically told him, like, if you wrestle again, we're not going to pay out your insurance because your back is in terrible shape. And so this would be the end of his career. And obviously this injury would kind of turn out good for him in a way, because it would lead him into DDP Yoga and where he is today. So, you know, it all worked out for DDP. Good guy. Dave saw a tape of the latest Ring of Honor show. So additionally to TNA, we have Ring of Honor running now. Latest Ring of Honor show, he says, is good. A show from top to bottom as he's seen in any promotion in the world all year. He said there are several four-star level matches. AJ Styles, Low Key, Brian Danielson, Spanky, Amazing Red, Doug Williams. And he sees star potential in all of these guys. And hard to argue with him on that one. This was interesting, too, to see this guy. Deathmatch wrestler Necro Butcher nearly had to have his arm amputated after a match with Madman Pondo left his arm punctured with a light bulb tube.
Jesus.
So, nice little window into the, you know, the non-WWE wrestling scene here in The Observer. AJ Styles was on The Observer Live recently. He talked about why he chose not to sign with WWE, because they only offered him $500 per week and he couldn't uproot his family and move to Cincinnati to work in OVW. As of now, even with his wrestling career, he still works full-time in landscaping. I had never known that about AJ Styles. Oh, wow. And also that his wife is in college where they live. And then finally, this, I don't know if you guys, JT, you might know. Construction is underway at WWE Niagara Falls, a new entertainment complex being built there, which will have a restaurant, rides, indoor laser tag, etc. They hope to have it open in the summer. And supposedly this ends up lasting for 10 years, I read. I had never heard of this before in my entire life.
Yeah, I had heard of it. It's one of those like anomaly things. I feel like they were going to put a ride in there too, and it just kind of existed. You never heard much about it. I don't think they ever even talk about it like on TV, but it definitely did exist. I remember reading about it years later as well. And I don't know. It's kind of like that. Then they buy some casino too, or some shit in Vegas that never went anywhere.
Yeah, I've heard of that too.
Yeah, odd.
Yeah, but like you said, it is weird that they wouldn't, because like WWF New York / the world is like, they pimp that shit constantly. So it's weird that they never. You know, and it's weird that it lasted that.
Didn't think it was like cool or something, you know?
Yeah, and that it lasted that long is kind of amazing. Like that it closed in 2011, which is insane. But
that's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but anyway, that wraps up our news and notes. We'll head right into the show. So our first show is going to be the July 1st, 2002 Raw, live from Manchester, New Hampshire. And like we mentioned earlier, so JT, you were at this show. Do you have any stories on like how this came to be, like how you ended up going to the show and what posse was with you or what have you?
Yeah, I think it was one of the more, like, I have some outlandish stories about going to live shows, but I think this was one of the more basic ones. My buddy Charlie, who was my roommate in college, and I would have just graduated right before this in May, he was a year behind us, but he lived, like, right near Manchester in New Hampshire. So we were obviously home for the summer. I hadn't gotten a full-time job right then yet. I was still working at, like, the supermarket or whatever. So I was just, like, bumming around, and he was like, oh, Raw's going to be in Manchester. Do you want to come up and, you know, we'll go? And I said, okay, cool. So myself, Adam Murray, who some may know from the NBA team here at P2B from years ago, and my buddy Jim drove up. We picked up Charlie at his house and then went to the show. Like, I don't remember a ton else. Like, I don't remember going to eat or anything weird. I remember very vividly where we sat, and I remember the show, most of it. I remembered most of the show being there and being super into specifically the main event. But honestly, I think it was one of the more basic live experiences that I've been to. Like, it was just kind of just bought tickets, we went, and it was a good show. So I was excited to be there. I'd never been up to a show in Manchester, so it was kind of cool to add, you know, it's always cool to add an arena to the repertoire. So
All right, well, yeah, so you kind of, because this, the main event was, is, has been kind of hyped, but they haven't made it, you know, I don't know if going into it, you've thought it would be, like anyone thought it would lead to some moment that has stood the test of time, kind of, that people always remember, so it's pretty cool. But anyway, we start the show with Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman coming to the ring. Heyman comes out and says that this is going to be the summer of Brock, and he will become the champion at SummerSlam as he is the number one contender. Brock then mimics Angle's challenge from last week's SmackDown, where he says that in the same way Angle pretty much challenged anyone who had never faced, basically like a rookie, Brock wants to face any veteran that is willing to face him. And so to heed the call is Ric Flair. He comes down. And he says that he hasn't forgotten that Brock has costed him against Vince, which I had kind of forgotten, even though it was just a few weeks ago, because of how quickly that all came together. Brock actually gets on the mic, which is kind of rare at this point, and he says that this is Flair's in the wrong place in the wrong year, and we pretty much go straight into the match. So kind of interesting that we go into this without like a 10-minute long promo. They kind of got to it fairly quickly for what it was. Heyman kind of rambled for a little while, but so kind of a big match right out of the gate to see Brock and Flair going at it. They kind of feel each other out to start off. Rick is going after him with the big chops and doing his normal Rick routine, doing the woos and everything. And so basically he's trying to use his veteran savvy, his chops, to try and work over Brock, but Brock's sheer force and power is too much for him, and he starts just hammering Rick. Brock then finally hits the post as Flair dodges him to give Flair a little bit of hope, but then Brock stops him again and slows things down with a bear hug. And JR is really selling at this point kind of the uncertainty of the title picture at this point, with Brock as the number one contender and sort of how many people are in the mix, because now we have The Rock that's sort of in the title picture now. Rick does his patented low blow spot where the ref is kind of looking up, and he goes down low and hits Brock in the nuts. And every time Rick goes for a pin, Brock kind of just throws him off pretty violently, and Rick sells it really well and flies up in the air. Finally, Flair manages to get the figure forearm, but Brock grabs the ropes. Heyman gets up. He gets clocked by, I want to say it was Flair moved out the way, and then Brock hits him. But then he walks right into an F5, which gives Brock the win. I thought this was a pretty cool opener, kind of unexpected. Pretty cool match to come out of nowhere. They had a pretty solid story. It wasn't anything amazing, I thought, but it was a really fun opener. But just a simple story of like the veteran Flair trying to use his savvy because he knows he doesn't have the power that Brock does. So that was a pretty good little story. So I went 2.5 on this one. What'd you think, Logan?
I actually went 2.5 as well. I wanted to point out something in the promo before the match. Flair actually points out that Brock actually cost him the match for the ownership of Raw, so I thought that was a nice little bit mm-hmm. of continuity that they mentioned mm-hmm. in the promo beforehand. But yeah, like you said, Lesnar used his power early and really often throughout the match. And, you know, Flair had kind of had to use some speed and escapability to kind of get anything in on Lesnar. You know, he kind of had to duck and dodge and kind of get his chops in where he could. And, he used his usual dirty techniques as well. At one point there was a spine buster that Lesnar did. I thought it was pretty brutal. And I also made the note that Flair's done a complete 180 in this match from the last time I was on here, because it was back when he was the owner of Raw, and he was such a loser, and he just moped all the time. So he really brought it in this match. But yeah, the Heyman distraction costed him, and Brock at that five for the win for sure. But yeah, I thought it was really solid, and it kind of came out of nowhere for me. But yeah, I went 2.5 like you.
I'm gonna take us back all the way to the open of the show real quick. The opening promo before the show started, where they recap mm-hmm. the Ruthless Aggression speech from last week, which was obviously awesome. Great speech and fitting. When I heard it, when I was watching the show, like, I jumped up. I was like, ah, I know that speech. Hear it every other week. But I loved the classic, I call it the Christmas music, but it's the one of, like, the old production songs they'd use from, like, 98.
Yeah.
I have them all downloaded because I was using them for the briefly lived Kevin Kelly Podcast League. But they haven't used it a ton at this point, but they resurrected it, and I thought it was awesome because it's such a good dramatic song. Anyway, so I just really loved that open. I thought the promo was good too. I like the Summer of RVD, thing that Heyman went in on. I also like the touch where Angle has been offering the rookies the matches on SmackDown, and Brock says, fuck it, I'm going to offer a veteran because he's a rookie. So I kind of like the dichotomy there, how that plays off. And again, it's kind of been the theme on Raw to throw out a huge match with no build. I mean, obviously that's what led to Austin leaving, and now we get it again here, but this time they go through with it. And Brock just chucking Flair around. And I thought this match had a good crowd buzz. And honestly, I remember a good chunk of the show. I did not remember this match on the show being there. Wow. Like, if you would have asked me 6 months ago, did you ever see Brock Lesnar versus Ric Flair live? No, probably not. But there it is. So I guess it's cool. I could put that on my list. Brock impressed me so much in this match. Like, he's so effortless. His athleticism is insane. Even shit like a missed elbow drop, he gets such crazy height. Like, he just goes flying in the air and back down. And I thought Flair wrestled a smart match. He's sticking and moving. He's kind of using all his tricks, trying to get, through Lesnar. Lesnar's keeps marching at him. He just treats Flair like a rag doll, just chucking him around. And Flair just keeps using his shit. He keeps going to the throat, low blows, going to the eyes, doing whatever he can. I like that he actually got the figure four before the F5. And it was kind of a cool treat. I thought what was cool is Flair was treated with respect and not just like squash or wrecked. I know I've had this argument before with Scott when many years later when Umaga beats the shit out of Flair in like 06 or whatever. But at this point, like, I don't think Flair's there yet. So I like that he at least gives it a go with Brock and he's not just treated like nothing. So he gets kind of the respect piece in here. And he got his classic offense and the crowd is hot for it. Lesnar's awesome. And it's just another big win for his belt. So I went 2 3/4. I thought that's a really fun opener. I like the way they presented Flair and Brock is just like next level already.
Yeah. It's something I've talked about in here. It's like, you can immediately tell that Brock was not going to be another just like big muscled up stiff. Like, he's right from out of the gate. He is, I wouldn't say he's completely got it, like what he would become, but he's pretty damn good right from the get go. But, and you also mentioned like the ruthless aggressive thing, not the name of the podcast, but, it had to be like Vince was in their ear telling them to just repeat it because you were to do a drinking game here, they say it so fucking much. Like every time they cut the commentary, like, well, that's ruthless aggression. So,
yeah. Definitely trying to get it over as a catchphrase. By the way, I don't think it comes up this week at all, but last week you guys talked about the Raven stuff getting fired. I think this is the start of his Heat run too, right? Like where he kind of becomes like the main guy on Heat that eventually I think tails into Stevie Knight Heat. But it always reminds me of the awesome story where when he got rehired in 2000 and Vince said, who the fuck hired Raven in the meeting? and just when I heard you guys talking about it, I read over and typed the note in my notes. It's always one of my favorite wrestling stories of all time. Like, just imagine being Raven. You're all excited to be back in the company. They're red hot. You're sitting in the first meeting and the owner looks at you. Who the fuck hired this guy?
Well, this guy.
It's going to make you feel great. So anyway, I knew we weren't going to talk about Raven, so I just wanted to work that in. I think he goes full time to Heat or some shit because I know he wasn't allowed to go to SmackDown either.
So misunderstood, poor Raven. We head backstage and we have Jackie Gata, Tough Enough winner, speaking with Coach about not winning the bikini contest that was heavily hyped, the Thongathon, if you will. She blames Molly for losing their tag match. Molly comes in and says that if she focuses more on wrestling and not wearing such scandalous outfits, that she would be a better wrestler. Jackie says that, well, at least she looks good in a bikini. And so Molly starts beating the hell out of her, drags her all the way down to the ramp, starts choking her out with a pipe. She hits a sick snap suplex outside the ring and then slaps the piss out of her. So kind of, you know, it was a little goofy at first, but eventually it got to a pretty good heel beatdown by Molly, I thought. Jackie is, you know, it's Jackie, but I thought this was good to have Molly actually show some physicality instead of just, you know, being the prude. But then to end the segment, Trish comes out and exposes the infamous granny panties, quote unquote, of Molly. So thoughts on the granny panties and the beatdown, JT?
I mean, I thought it was really good, at least when Molly was beating up Jackie. It was hard hitting. You don't usually see that with the women at this point. I think everyone always thinks of later in the year is like when that stuff starts to really start up. But Molly was really unloading here. I don't know if it was like a hazing type of thing with Jackie and just trying to, you know, initiate her in. But she really beats the shit out of her. I mean, choking with the pipe, really vicious stuff. I thought Jackie showed decent fire, too, for being so green. Like, she didn't, if you didn't know, this was like just a couple weeks in for her. Like, I don't think it was terribly obvious. And I like Trish coming out, too, for the save. To me, the worst part of this whole thing was Lawler. No shock there. He was just terrible throughout all this. And but I thought it started shaky with Jackie in the makeup chair, but by the end I thought it was really good. I like the tracking shot they do too, where it never really cuts. It just starts with the backstage, follows through the fight and through Trish making the save. And even though Molly looked awesome through most of it, I do think the finish kind of looked dumb with the granny panties and Lawler. It was so counterproductive after they made it look like such a badass heel throughout the whole segment. Like, why can't she just come out on top and leave her laying, you know? What'd you think, Logan?
I really like the beatdown. And Jackie, I don't know where she's originally from, but her accent is like wicked strong. She really inflects all of her words, and you could kind of tell that she's new because she's really trying to make sure you can understand what she's saying.
If you're saying that, Logan, I must be strong. She's actually from Ohio. So I don't know. It's kind of a weird one.
She sounds like she's from like Minnesota or something, but I don't know. That just really caught me off guard because I feel like she was like really.
She's from Strongsville, Ohio. I don't know if that's like that's like very northern Ohio. So wouldn't that be almost like Minnesota? Probably.
Yeah, Minnesota. Michigan, that sort of thing.
She might have a little bit of Michigan in her, but I really liked the beatdown. It was a really good brawl, and it showed Molly Holly's vicious side, like JT was saying. So that was always good to see, and it got pretty lame towards the end. I just made the very last note I took on this segment was just sheesh. Like, how could they be so freaking thick-headed and do something like that with the granny panties and all that? But this isn't going away, I'm afraid to say.
Yeah, and the thing is, the crowd is pretty into it, honestly. Like, the crowd kind of gets into it a little bit, so.
Well, yeah, we didn't have to hear Lawler being a fucking douche.
Yeah. True.
And Trish is really an asshole when she was walking away. She's, like, extending her hands, like, oh my gosh, your ass is this big, and she's, like, holding her hands out. I was like, and Trish is the face in this scenario?
I know. It sucks. And Molly's, like, on fire in this stretch, and, you know, you've started chronically with Jake, and you're going to follow through, but it's like, she's so good in the ring and as this heel role, and it just sucks that this is like what's driving it, you know?
Yeah. It's like, you need, like you mentioned, you need more of the beatdown stuff that shows that she's a badass and less of this less humiliating.
But and even if, like, I feel like if King wasn't there, even with the granny panty stuff, maybe it's not as bad. Like, if it's Heyman still on commentary from like a year ago, or even Taz, or just anyone, like, maybe it's not as obnoxious. Like, I don't know how much he adds to it on top of it with, like, just hammering it home, isn't helping the situation.
I think it's the fat part is the worst part of it. Right. Because if it was just a granny panty, you could be like, oh, well, she's like a dork, you know? Like,
or a prude, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You could play that up. But then you start calling her fat, and that's when it really gets bad. But, unfortunately, I'm sure we'll see more. But we head backstage to the new guy on the scene, Chris Nowinski, and he explains that he doesn't want the hardcore title from Bradshaw because he's from Harvard, and basically he says that he likes rules and he doesn't want to have to defend the title all the time like you have to do with the hardcore title, and so like he's basically above it. So we transition from that straight into the match, which is him versus Bradshaw. We actually did get a pretty good King line here, because he says that Bradshaw went to Abilene Christian and he said, you put that diploma on your dash and you can get to park in the handicap spot. So that was like, that was more of a good, like, mid-90s King line. So I kind of enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. But Bradshaw immediately goes for the weapons. The ref goes to take the chair, which I thought was odd because it's a hardcore title match. And then Nowinski sneaks in with the cowbell that Bradshaw had got to the brought to the ring. And then that, that was pretty much the whole match. it was kind of big. It was more of a storyline than anything. It really wasn't much of a match. I went half a star on it. It was pretty much to show that Nowinski is sneaky. So I guess the best I can say about Nowinski so far is that I do kind of want to see him get beat up, but he definitely has not looked particularly impressive. What'd you guys think? Logan?
Yeah, I went half a star as well. Nowinski either had like dried blood or he had like a skin condition going on his chest. I don't know what that was all about, but it kind of looked like he had been bleeding and he like got some of it on his chest and then washed it off or something like that. So that kind of distracted me a little bit. But yeah, this is pretty basic and just, there's an immediate distraction with the chair and the ref gets distracted and he hits him with the cowbell. So it wasn't too much of anything, but it gets another win for Nowinski. So it'll be interesting to see where he goes from here.
I think Nowinski had the character stuff down pretty well out of the gate. I know they thought he was, and he is a really good athlete, but I'm wondering if they missed the boat early and just should have just had him be like a mouthpiece and then eventually maybe get in the ring or just be someone who could get us comeuppance. Like, he's not that far off from another early TNA guy, Mortimer Plumtree, we're watching. he's like a bigger guy, so maybe he looked weird managing someone, but I think because his character and his talking is there, but in ring, he's still piecing it together and he's still kind of awkward and lanky. So maybe they would have been better off just sticking him in that role out of the gate. But, him talking down to everyone and whatnot, I kind of like that he wants to know part of the hardcore division and the title, but he's stuck in it. And I didn't really understand why the ref stopped Bradshaw from using the chair. Like, that was kind of random. Yeah. I guess it's not a hardcore match, but it was just odd. And then Nowinski hits it. And they didn't really explain it or make it clear that it wasn't a hardcore match until that happened.
Yeah.
I went half a star as well, just kind of not too much going on.
Yeah, good point. They maybe could have had him just be like Regal's lackey for a while, like in the same way how they brought Batista in. And so for the first little while, he's kind of just Devon's lackey. And maybe could have done that with him and Regal. But yeah, it was, you could have, maybe it was implied that they didn't want to follow the rules because like Nowinski refused to do hardcore rules or something. But yeah, it wasn't super clear. But speaking of Regal, we head back in. RVD is speaking to Regal because RVD is looking for Brock Lesnar. Regal is upset at this rude gesture and wants RVD to apologize for barging in on him. And basically what this leads to is them RVD challenging him to a match. So just kind of a simple way for them to set up a match for later. And then we head to Terry. As we go through our typical like rapid fire promos backstage, Terry is with Jeff Hardy and she mentions that he is the ultimate underdog. He says that being an underdog is steep because it's a ladder match and he's basically the expert on ladder matches and Taker has never been in one, which I think throughout this whole show is a really cool caveat to this is that Taker has never been in a ladder match, which is kind of something you would think by this point he's done everything, but he hasn't apparently. And then Hardy just starts going like weird and insane and starts climbing all over.
Yeah, really.
It was like a little bit awkward because he just acted kind of. It's like, I see what he was going for, but it came off as just like, he just looked kind of dumb, but I did like his last line.
It was like parkour before parkour. It was odd.
Yeah. He was like, look how crazy I am. I'm going to climb on stuff. It's like, all right, man, whatever. But I did like his last line because they're in New Hampshire. And he says that New Hampshire's, motto or whatever is live free or die. And so I thought that was much better than him, parkouring all over the backstage area.
He definitely took a hit off the good stuff before this.
It looks like parkour is older than I thought, so I guess maybe it wasn't before parkour. Maybe, I think it was before it definitely caught on. It became like a big thing. Because that had to be what later on. I remember it the most culturally from The Office when they do it in the open, and that had to be probably like late 2000s. But it was odd when he like runs around like a cat after, but I do like that he's kind of cocky about it because he does have this experience and it fits his character. Like he's not someone that's going to hide or, just admit that he'd be scared or anything like that. And we've seen that in the build that you guys have covered, right? That he's, he keeps asking for a match and keeps trying to earn his respect and not backing down. So he's trying to ball out and show that he is ruthlessly aggressive and can take that brass ring. So I thought this is good. I thought Regal's promo on RVD was good too. Like he just got really pissed at him and yelled at him. So this is two pretty good back-to-back character building segments.
And then we get another one right after this where we have Goldust continuing his trend of dressing in random costumes is Dressed as Darth Vader. He tells Booker T that he is not a Jedi yet. And I always love Booker T's response to this, because he responds, "I ain't no Star Wars geek," which was funny. Like,
I ain't no fucking Andy Atherton.
It's just funny. Like, Star Wars, like the most popular media property. He's like, "Hey, what do you think? I like Star Wars." Like these other like 4 billion people. but it's such like a Booker T thing to think like he's a geek. And there's definitely like some phallic imagery with Goldust with his lightsaber swinging it around. But Goldust says he has a plan. And Booker T always gets like at first he's always questioning Goldust's weird stuff, and then he gets kind of into it. Like here he gets into the lightsaber. Like at first he's like, "Man, this is weird. I'm not a geek." And then he's like, "Man, this lightsaber's pretty cool, man." And then he calls himself Obi-Book Kenobi and says that he's going to be the 5-time Jedi champ. So this was just good Booker T and Goldust nonsense that I feel like only they could pull off.
And they've been awesome. And I'm glad as you're reviewing this, like I felt this way too on Wrestling Warzone that with Chad and I were doing with like Sting and Luger, how it's one of those things that's like remembered really fondly and you hope it holds up when you watch it back, you know? And I feel like this has always been looked at as like Booker and Goldust were so much fun. They did these skits and they were a great team. And like, I'm really happy that it's holding up, that you guys have, you know, you and your guests have enjoyed it every week, and that this was great. And it's just really cool that this does hold up to the reputation. And this was really funny. I like how into this Booker is. Like, he was reluctant at first, but now he's sold. He's like all in on being Goldust buddy, to the point where he's pretty much sold out the NWO because of it. And I like here how he tries to play cool and then just gives in and basically admits that he's a huge Star Wars wonk. So this was good. This is a really good moment. And it capitalizes, I think. Hadn't Phantom Menace just come out, or was about to come out?
I want to say...
I think Attack of the Clones.
Yeah.
Was Attack of the Clones? Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. But we're still, like, in, you know, like, fully in prequel Star Wars. Like, you know, that whole era is, like, you know, it's like the Star Wars sort of rebirth.
Where... It literally had just come out May 16th. So.
Oh, wow. Okay.
A month and a half before Attack of the Clones, yeah.
Yeah. Good. But yeah, I like too that like it is, it's not super heavy hand. Like I like all the subtleties of like how Booker T is always questioning him and then gets on board, and kind of how long they drew it out and that it took Booker T a while to really get on board with Booker T and with Goldust and his weirdness. So it's been kind of a low key sort of slow burn of them coming together, which has been fun to watch too. So yeah, I enjoy them. It holds up well. But anyway, we go again, still backstage. Now we go to Vince's office, and Eddie Guerrero is with Vince, and he wants to know, Vince wants to know what ruthless aggression is in Spanish. And Eddie Guerrero says, "It's Eddie Guerrero," which I thought was a fucking great line. And then Benoit comes in, and significant here is that Benoit is dressed for action because he has been back, you know, he's been back on the scene, but he hasn't been able to wrestle. So this kind of hints to us like he's actually going to be wrestling tonight. So we should see him later tonight. So this was sort of just, I think the main purpose of this segment was to show that Benoit is going to be wrestling, like showing him in his wrestling gear. Any thoughts on this, guys? This is kind of just a quick hit little Eddie promo.
Yeah, Go ahead. I think him saying, you know, ruthless aggression in Spanish, Eddie Guerrero, like, that was cool. And I think Benoit, this is really just established he's going to be on Raw. And Vince basically says, like, "I owe SmackDown, so you better, you know, you better be great here on Raw because, you know, SmackDown had you, and I basically took it from there." So, but it's good because they're really doing a nice job setting up Benoit's return as a big deal. We'll see if it holds, but for now, anyway, like, they're definitely hyping it like it's a major coup for him to be on the show.
Yeah, this was the first like big trade that they did. So like they get Raw gets Benoit because he was originally drafted to SmackDown. So it's and they kind of really play up him up as a big deal. So it's a they act like it's a big get for Raw at this point to get Benoit. So they really kind of hype him up pretty well.
Yeah, and like a lot of people, I find like if you read like when I'm looking at the news and stuff, like Meltzer will give his you know critiques of this stuff, and I feel like people at the time were like hammering them on this, like, "Oh, look, you did the draft, and now you're going back on it." Mm-hmm. I mean, it really doesn't bother me that much. I mean, you know, it's not like they're completely disregarding all of it. It's just kind of like, well, he was injured, things have changed, they want him on Raw now, so it didn't really like you know, I'm not really upset about it. It's fine with me. But we'll continue on. So now we're going to get the Regal RVD match that was hyped a second ago. So Regal comes in. And so pretty much the structure of this match was that Regal controlled with his kind of typical Regal offense, like strikes and holds. And he does a lot of rapid pin attempts. And so he kind of just keeps working RVD over with that sort of stuff until finally RVD kind of fires up and does his normal comeback routine with all his unorthodox offense, as JR would say, and then wins with the five-star frog splash. Nothing special, but not a bad way to kill a few minutes of TV. And it does give RVD a win, as he has been, you know, it's good for him to pick up a solid win. It was almost kind of came off as like a jobber to the star sort of match, just like a touch above a squad basic structure. And also noted that Regal is the European champion, and he basically just got like beat in like 5 minutes. So it shows you what they think of the European title at this point. But I went 2 stars on it. What'd you think, JT?
Yeah, it was, big WrestleMania rematch as well. This was the match at 18. It feels so different than it did just then. You also get JR plugging The Rock's big return. I know you've been talking about that. That's coming next week. But yeah, non-title, neither match on the line. Regal went right to the suplexes. I like that half Nelson German. I thought that looked pretty good and kind of grinds RVD down and then into the finish. And I thought it was a hard-fought match. He didn't get a lot of time. I thought Regal, when he was on offense, looked pretty crisp and RVD flowed with him. They have some chemistry. Like, we saw that earlier in the year, and they could have used more time here, but... right now, they just kind of sacrificed Regal because Van Damme's getting, you know, another rebooted push here pretty much, and they're trying to use him to really get Brock over. So it made sense for him to go over clean on this. So I went 2.5, but I just enjoy the chemistry these guys have together.
Yeah, I went 2 stars like you, Jake, and I thought Regal really came out and was aggressive, and that half Nelson suplex that JT mentioned, he absolutely murders him with that and almost drops him on his head, so I really liked that move. I thought Regal really dominated until RVD kind of got a reversal into the monkey flip, and then he kind of hit his regular moves of doom to set up the 5-star frog splash. But yeah, I thought it was a pretty solid, probably pretty solid match, and it did a lot for RVD.
Yeah, and as JT alluded to, so after the match, Van Damme calls out Brock, and Heyman commends his guts, but says that he will spare him Brock for tonight, basically saying they're not going to have the match tonight. But Heyman challenges him at Vengeance, which pretty much sets up RVD versus Brock at Vengeance. So this is a feud that has been building, and so they're going to continue at Vengeance. I think it's a good feud for Brock, as he's obviously set up to main event or, you know, fight for the title at SummerSlam. And, RVD is kind of a upper mid card, probably the highest you can get without being a main eventer at this point. So it's a good sort of stepping stone for him. So it makes perfect sense. And they, from what the matches that they had before have been pretty damn good. So I can't complain about it.
It's a good, he's a good gatekeeper type guy, RVD, to get you to that next level. So like you said, he's about as high as you can go up the card at this point before becoming a main event star. Did Heyman call him Rob E, or did I mishear that?
No, he did.
Yeah, odd. I remember him like as Robbie V in WCW, but I was like, when the fuck was he ever Rob E? Yeah. It was very odd. I don't know what he was, inside joke maybe or whatever, but anyway, it's an interesting match, and I'll be curious when you get to Vengeance what you think of it, because as much as you want to use RVD as that gatekeeper to the main event scene for Brock, given that RVD is your second tier champion and they do have big plans for him, you wonder if there's someone else that could have used in this role, because it's going to end up being a situation where, like, are you going to put Brock clean over him again? You just did it at King of the Ring. RVD's clearly not going to beat Brock because he's headed to SummerSlam. So I don't know if I'm trying to think quick. I mean, it's so because, like, Booker's in the middle of a big push. You don't really want to do him. And I just don't know who else would have been at that level for him to beat. So maybe RVD is the best option, but it's just they're kind of putting themselves in a tight spot by using him.
Yeah, I agree, because he is, because then you're kind of like, well, he's, you know, the champ, so what are you going to, you know, how does the title play into this? But yeah, I agree with you. It's like almost like they should have tried to build somebody else up. I almost feel like if they wouldn't have cut Bradshaw could be, that would have been something good for him, but that ship sailed a long time ago when they kind of gave up on him. So
and you know, it would have been good, but he's not around right now, is Kane. You know, if he would have hurt. That would have been a perfect guy because he could take the loss and be perfectly fine. Booker's the only one, other one I could think of, honestly. And, you know, I don't know if it's easier to sacrifice him right now. You know, maybe the NWO could have helped out or something. It is what it is, but it seems like they want to give both these guys the same push in a way. Maybe not exactly the same. Obviously, Brock's pegged for bigger things, but, and then it's not exactly sure how to go about it.
Yeah, it's tough to say. I don't know. But,
It's like you want Brock to get the win, but you don't, but you kind of want to keep RVD in that playing field where he may could challenge him after he wins the belt or if he's going to win the belt, you know? So,
right. Yeah. But
I definitely agree with y'all.
Yeah. It's kind of like the downside of having so many guys that are good is that you don't want to sacrifice any money. So, great. So our next match, we have a tag match between Benoit and Eddie against the lesser utilized Dudley combo, which is Bubba and Spike Dudley. And so, as I mentioned earlier, this will be Benoit's in-ring return after a very, very long layoff. He's been out for basically a year at this point. With, I think it was a neck injury, right?
It was the one when he blew his neck out at King of the Ring 01, and he had like the spinal fusion and all that deal, so it was a pretty serious injury at the time, and it seemed like it came like such a bad time for him because they had finally kind of gave him the shot, right? They were finally he had the awesome matches with Austin, the match with Austin on SmackDown, and then set that up, and then you wonder what role he would have played in the invasion. Like, it's weird to think he wasn't there for any of it. You know, he got hurt and then the invasion started pretty much that same night. The Dudley thing's interesting too, because I think it was Scott on the last episode said he didn't realize Spike was even like around still at this point. But some of his best shit is still to come, so it's funny that he almost is overlooked during this run. But he's still pretty tied in with the Dudleys for a while.
Yeah, and he's a good guy to just kind of throw in to fill a spot, and he can bump and get his ass kicked. So there's no problem with throwing him in there. So we start off, and Benoit comes out hot in his return. He looks good. He's nailing his signature German suplexes, taking some hard bumps that he's, you know, always known for. And as you would expect in this with the faces, Spike being on the face team, he starts getting isolated. They start wearing him out. So Bubba gets in, he kind of gets an advantage, and he calls for Spike to get the table, but Benoit kind of cuts him off. Eddie goes for the frog splash in the ring, but he misses and then gets hit with a Bubba bomb and gets pinned. I was conflicted. I'll let you guys speak on this one first before I get into my Bubba hatred. Logan, what did you think of this match?
It was kind of a mess early, and I feel like when Benoit got in, it got a little bit better, but I'm kind of joining you on the Bubba train. He's kind of ruffled me a few times lately watching the shows along with the podcast. But to start the match, Bubba's real tough, and he makes Spike start the match. So that kind of pissed me off to start off with. You would think Bubba would want to be the big brother to start the bludgeoning and get it going, you know. But when Guerrero and Bubba were in the match early, I feel like they weren't really on the same page. I feel like they botched a couple of things. But, like I said, when Benoit got in the match, it got a lot better, and he hit some brutal suplexes. He hits a German at one point on Bubba and just absolutely folds him up, and it looked like he landed on his neck, and I think they even kind of point that out on commentary. It was kind of a mess early, and it got a little bit better towards the end. But I hated the fact that Guerrero and Benoit actually lost, so I only went a star and a half.
Oh, wow. All right. I think it's funny that Bubba's already back in the tag team, by the way. So that title push did not last very long at all. And it's a big moment for Benoit's return. He looked ripped. I mean, he came back fully in shape. He did not lay off the weights while rehabbing. It's kind of sad in a way that the Dudleys have been reduced to just like a table gimmick. Like, the crowd chants for table immediately. Like, they don't even let it build. They're like, tables. Like, that's all they are, is like table clowns. His gear is absurd too, Bubba. It looks like there's such a slob. Oh,
it's terrible.
You even get fat jokes from JR and King about it. They say he's about to bust. He's bulking up for the winter. Like, it's fucking July. He's bulking up for the winter. They were harsh on him, but like they must have been. I'm curious how backstage, like, if they were not happy with him, like that they invested a bunch in him and he didn't really like take the leap, or maybe get himself into shape, you know, because years later, like, he does work his ass off and get his, you know, get into much better shape. So I do wonder how much of that played a role here, because they're usually when you get the JR mixed messages on commentary, it means something, you know, when he's calling you fat and shit. Like, so I really wonder if, like, they were, I don't know if anything will pop up in Meltzer or not, but I wonder if they were just not happy with the returns on the effort they gave on his push. Benoit and Guerrero both jacked. They're both angry and aggressive. I like that lengthy second heat segment on Spike. It's a pretty good anchor tag. You'd get that, I think, like, later years are more known for those, like 04 or 05, with those big anchor tags and six mans in the middle of Raw. But you get one here, so I thought that was pretty good. The hot tag was fine. You get the was up and all that shit. And then the finish completely shocked me. I love... But I love Benoit throwing Spike from the ring through the table. Like, that was a great spot.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is after match, obviously. And then Eddie hitting the frog splash on Bubba while he was in the crossface looked awesome too. So like the after match was good and the match was good. It's just the finish. Like, you don't need Bubba to take the loss if you're trying to give him any kind of hope. Just have Spike. Who gives a fuck about Spike at this point? Why can't Benoit just crush him with the crossface and win? Like, that's... It is tailor-made. It's his return match from a year off, and he's a guy you're going to push. Like, it just made no sense. The finish just, you know, took a little bit of steam, but the match I really liked, and the post-match was great. I went 3 stars. That was actually a really good tag. I just did not I did not like the finish at all. The finish was completely counterproductive.
Yeah, I had to kind of... I'm pretty close to you. I went 2.5. I had to try and separate, I guess, sort of the booking of, you know, how the finish and, you know, Eddie eating the pin and all that kind of stuff from the actual match. Like you said, I enjoyed the match a pretty good bit. It's just the finish was baffling. I had the same thing as you. Like, why not? It seems like that's why Spike's in the match. You know, it's to bump, get his ass beat, you know, get sympathy, and then take the pin, because it's like, it seems like you want, and I guess in their mind, it's like the post-match stuff was awesome. They looked really aggressive and brutal and ruthless, kind of beating the shit out of everybody and, you know, throwing Spike through the table. But to me, you could still do that. Like, really let them look like dominant heels and come in, beat Spike, then throw him through the table. But they have this weird thing where it's like, it's even more baffling because, like you said, they're kind of ragging on Bubba, but then at the same time, they weirdly seem like still into him. Like, they always want to make Bubba look good. Like, when he faced Brock, he's like looked like as he's one of the best guys against Brock so far. Like, he's got some of the most offense against Brock. It's so weird. They always seem like they want to protect him in a weird way. Him and his sweatpants and his stupid ass. But it's like, I agree. It's just weird to me. It seems like you want Benoit to look great on his comeback. Why are we protecting Bubba? And definitely, why are we protecting Spike? I thought it was stupid, but as a match, it was fine. So there's my Bubba hate for the week. So, but anyway, we'll carry on. Now we get backstage. We get okay. So Big Show is confronted by a Goldust. He says that he is his father, and then Big Show hits him, but Nash is there and he beats up Goldust with golf clubs, throws him into some golf clubs, starts beating the shit out of him. And then he tells Big Show he needs to win tonight or get his ass kicked. So probably not the smartest move by Goldust to pick shit with Big Show after he's been trolling.
You missed the best part of this, Jake. You missed the best part. Well, Goldust talks about his father, and he said, "My father's dead," which is an amazing callback to the 99 story.
Yes,
that's true. That was really funny. And then Goldust says, "I'm your father," and then he hits him with that fucking plastic lightsaber. Yeah, not a great plan by Goldust, but Nash is not happy with Show, calls him a bitch, basically. But that was really funny. I thought Show nailed the timing on it, too. He's like, "I know about your father. My father's dead."
Father's dead. Get dragged.
And Nash says, "Who's your daddy?" when he before he punches Goldust for the first time. So, golf clubs? Is that what he was taking him out with? I thought it was just like a random piece of metal he found.
I think I saw a golf club.
So I was just double checking.
Ever since Nash has come back, he's like screaming at the NWO, especially like X-Pac and Big Show. He's just constantly chewing their ass, like, "You better not lose, bitches!" Like,
I can't blame him. They've like ruined his legacy that he built. Yeah,
and like Sean's coming back to try and whip him into shape, because it's so weird, because then they do these goofy segments where it's like Show's taking a dump and stuff. And then, yeah, it's the NWO presentation is so all over the place. But after this, we get Logan Spank Bank material, which is a Jeff Hardy hype package of Jeff Hardy being Jeff Hardy with all his extreme movements and music and stuff like that. Did you enjoy the slogan? Did it get your motor running?
Yeah, that'll definitely be in the Spank Bank for later. I'll keep that one on file for sure.
Then we go to Terry, who's interviewing Undertaker about the match later. Undertaker says that he doesn't tap, so Angle needs a plan B. And then he says he's going to move on to Rock. And then Terry questions him, saying that, well, isn't he forgetting about Jeff Hardy tonight? And Taker pretty much gets pissed off and walks away. So they're really doing a good job building this of kind of keep constantly putting emphasis on that Taker is overlooking Jeff and putting this in your mind that, you know, is he, you know, he's overlooking him. He's in a match that he's not used to. It's a match that Jeff is sort of an expert at. And so they're really doing a good job of building up, you know, Jeff's chances and putting some, you know, doubt in our minds that Taker could actually lose this tonight. So I thought that's been good storytelling on the main event, I think, so far with them. And then we head on, and now we have Show. He finds X-Pac put through a table. And so now tonight we're going to have a singles match instead, and it will be Show versus Booker. Before we get to Show versus Booker, any thoughts on any of these things that we've gone through so far, JT?
No, those are all pretty basic. I'm with you. I like the through line throughout the show with building Taker and Hardy and really trying to cast some doubt, right? Just any kind of doubt that Taker's taking this lightly. He's looking ahead to SmackDown. Hardy, this is his kind of match. Taker's never been in a ladder match. So I think they're doing a good job of at least making you think that it's possible. And you know what? It's not impossible this time because the title has hot potatoed a bit. They haven't been against trying some radical things here in 2002. Like, I don't think it would have been the most insane thing if they gave Jeff Hardy like a week-long title reign at Taker's expense. There's nothing on the immediate horizon. It's not like there's a huge Taker title match set for Vengeance. I mean, they're kind of teasing The Rock, but there's nothing really like, you know, established. It's not like there's a big match set for Mania and there's no chance they take him out of it or something like that. So I think there's enough pieces here to make you wonder if this is something they may do.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think it's, like you said, it's very in flux. Like, they haven't had one guy they've run with since Mania. It's kind of bounced around a little bit because either the Hogan, now Taker, it definitely seems like they're in a transitional phase. So there's no, you know, it's definitely, you could see them just throwing on Jeff for a few weeks or something just to, you know, pop everybody and surprise everyone.
Even three nights. I mean, he could have bust the back on SmackDown or something. Yeah, so true. Definitely a lot of options.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, Brock's a heel and Taker's still technically a heel at this point, even though he's kind of starting to fade towards kind of a tweener kind of area. So you could, I mean, not that I thought Jeff was actually going to make it to SummerSlam with the title, but you know, it, that could provide the face to go against Brock's obvious heel. But yeah, I like that they're kind of, he even talks about facing Kurt on SmackDown. He mentions that and he mentions The Rock. So it's, they did a real good job of showing that he's kind of overlooking Jeff and, kind of building up that he has a chance because it's in his kind of playground, you know?
Yeah. All right. So as I mentioned a second ago, our next match is going to be Big Show versus Booker T. Booker comes in hot, but to no avail as Big Show kind of starts ping-ponging him around the ring. Booker bumps around. He finally fights out of the Big Show bear hug and hits a heel kick. But again, it's not enough for Show as he knocks Booker down again. Show then takes things outside. He grabs the steps, but Booker T knocks him down and they sort of do the spot where Show kind of falls and hits his head on the steps. Finally, Show is knocked out and they actually do a count out finish, which the funny part of this is like you tell they're going for the count out because the ref is counting so fucking fast, like way faster than they ever count. He's like 7, 8, 9, 10. So that was kind of funny. But for how it was pretty short, but for how long it lasted, I was kind of surprised that that Show went down like this, that they went with this. But I thought this is more to just push the storyline, give Booker T a win as they're heating up. And we will get some post-match shenanigans here. But yeah, more to push the storyline. I thought it made sense. It does kind of protect Show because he didn't pin him. It sort of comes off as a little bit fluky. But for the match itself, I went a star and a half. What'd you think, Logan?
Yeah, I went a star and a quarter. I thought Big Show looked really stupid with the steps thing at the end. But, yeah, for the little bit of action we got, you know, like you said, Big Show kind of ping-pong Booker around, trying to chuck him around. He did a pretty cool stalling suplex at one point. I don't know what it is about that move, but I seem to always point that out when that happens. But I really like that move, and it was pretty cool to see how long he could keep him up there. But when Booker T hits that like wheel kick that you mentioned, he gets some major height on it, because you know Big Show's a 7 foot tall guy, so Booker has to really jump super high in the sky to hit him with that. So it was more to lead to what happens after the match, but it wasn't too bad for what it was worth.
Yeah, it was all right. I mean, Booker's getting really over. Like, he gets a big pop when he comes out here, even though he's still kind of a tweener. Show looked, I mean, he's starting to look real terrible. Like, he looks really bloated. He looks like he's like poured into those tights, and then he's trying to like fast walk to the ring to show he's angry. It just looks kind of stupid because he can't really move that fast. So it was, you know, he's just not looking great. That suplex did look awesome though. That was the highlight of the match, and I thought he looked like a goof too with the finish with the stairs. Like, give me something a little bit more. It would have been better if Booker hit him and he fell into the stairs or something, you know, versus that. I always hate when they do the with the stairs falling someone, because it just doesn't look like it hurts at all. Nothing match, honestly. Couple of spots, a dumb ending. Show looks like a clown. And Booker kind of looks lucky, too. Like, he doesn't look like he really beat him. So I just want to start in a quarter. I like Booker and Goldust a lot. It feels like they just got to get away from this NWO shit right now.
Yeah, so after the match, Booker T kind of knows that the NWO is coming for him, so he heads out through the crowd. Sean and Nash come out there pissed off. Sean finally does settle down and starts trying to keep the peace with everyone, because he knows Nash is going to be pissed off. And he says that if it was Book that took out Pac, then next week they're going to take him out. And then Sean says that the NWO is a family, and that one member has been injured, and that he knows that he's watching at home right now. And then he basically just kind of draws this out and really milks it, trying to get it, you know, builds the anticipation for what he's going to say. And it's really shocking, because you kind of think this is going to be a cliffhanger. He's not going to actually tell us.
Right.
He says those who watch King of the Ring know. And then he outright says it, that it's going to be Triple H. So he comes out and says that next week we can expect Triple H to be joining the NWO. Or I don't know if he said next week, but basically soon. It's going to it's going to be Triple H. So I was kind of shocked that he said it. It had all the makings of like them drawing it out. Be like, tune in next week to find out. But he just said it. So you kind of knew where he was going with it, but it is definitely sort of a big angle, you know, if Triple H is going to join the NWO. So a big announcement for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, it's really the first seed of what's going to be like their big summer angle coming up. So it's funny that they sneak it in here. You know, I liked Show and Nash kind of clocking each other before the promo, and then Sean basically telling them to shut up. And he says he's a dysfunctional family. And they kind of hint that it's X-Pac at first, and then it's not, and they say Triple H. And then after the announcement, Sean tells them to hug and make up, and they do. And then Sean super kicks Show and says it's tough love, and then they kind of call him. It's kind of a weird use of Sean to steer the sinking ship. I mean, the NWO is clearly not going anywhere. But if it's his way to get an entry point back and then, you know, get into the issue with Triple H, I guess it was kind of a shrewd way to do it. Even though right now it seems kind of weird that he's basically some manipulating leader. And that's what they're using him as, right? It kind of feels like this is like they're playing off his backstage rep from like 97, 98 as like the leader of the clique. And he's kind of playing mind games with them all and just trying to use them for his own gain. It's just, it's a weird, like, lost to time stretch of Shawn Michaels in the NWO in WWE. And again, Show looks stupid. I mean, just gets super kicked.
And he completely leans into that switching music too. Like, you could tell he was totally about to receive it too, because he's like, please, Mr. Michaels, super kick me in the face. You know, he almost basically just like leaned right into it. But yeah, they're kind of starting to weed out all of the guys that aren't, you know, click guys. So it's gonna be like the four click guys or the NWO. So, but yeah, they make Big Show look like a big jamoke in this match, or the match and the promo afterwards. So.
Yeah, they're definitely kind of conflating like the Click, DX, and the NWO as all one kind of, you know, because it's so weird, because it's like, you know, he's an NWO guy, Triple H, and it's like, well, not really. He's like friends with all y'all, but he was never in the NWO. But yeah, this is weird. Like, watching all this, I don't remember much of this. I remember the angle that's coming up with Triple H, obviously, but all of this the Sean transition back into things is kind of, it's kind of odd, but I guess if it gets where we're going, then it is what it is. Like you said, JT, it's, you know, I guess you got to fit him in somewhere. But we head backstage, and this is a common trope on these shows lately, is that people go into Vince's office to bitch. And so Taker goes into Vince's office. He's basically complaining that he wants to Rock. And Vince pretty much tells him, well, you could have the Rock whether you're champion or not, which Taker obviously takes offense to, because it implies that he, there's any chance that he could lose to Jeff Hardy tonight. And he says that when he leaves the ring, Jeff won't be able to stand. Okay, is which will become a very important line to the story that they're going to tell in the match. Mm-hmm. And then we find out that Lita is back. Lita, who has been injured after she got injured on the set of Dark Angel or whatever, is back to support Jeff in his big match. So, and with that, we will head to our
big... They're always awkward for some reason. For three people that are like basic, I mean, mainly family, right? I mean, they've been around each other forever. They still seem awkward when they're together. Like Lita comes in kind of all shucks, and it's like, they're just, I don't know. There's everything about them, like, screams awkward outcast kids in high school or something, like the way they act. But it's cool. I mean, it's cool. It makes it feel bigger that Lita shows up and roots the Hardy on, and it definitely makes a little extra bonus for the match.
Yeah, Jeff always has this like awkward energy in any kind of backstage segment. Like earlier when he's running around like a fool, like he always has this kind of weirdo, I don't know, kind of uncomfortable feeling about him. What are you saying, Logan? Drugs.
It's the drugs. I'm just kidding. But yeah, I just think they're like, I think the Hardys are just good old Southern boys that just don't know how to act in front of the camera. I think it took them a really long time to kind of get comfortable with being on TV and kind of being in. I just feel like they're really awkward naturally, and it shows even worse when they're like in front of the camera and it's just them, you know.
But with that, we will head into our big main event: Taker versus Jeff Hardy, ladder match for the title. We've had a nice build to this before the show and throughout this show. And I think there's a good energy going into the match. Like, it definitely has sort of a, I don't want to say like a big fight feel, but it definitely feels like you're about to watch something like that's going to be memorable going into it. And I don't know if that's just me, like hindsight talking, but so we start off. I thought the opening spot was really awesome as Jeff kind of distracts Taker by going the bike. Taker goes out to get him off. And while Taker's kind of preoccupied with that, he grabs the ladder and kicks it right into Taker's face. So I thought it was a good, interesting way for him to take an advantage and immediately establish like that this is sort of Jeff, like that Jeff has the home field advantage, basically, with it being a ladder match, and he knows how to use the ladder. So I thought it was a really cool spot. He starts blasting Taker with a chair, which I thought was a really good idea. Like it's like he knows he's overmatched, so he knows he has to use weapons and stuff. And so we continue really pushing that Taker has never been in a ladder match on commentary to add to this as we go in the early going. But then finally Taker kind of takes the advantage because he rocks Jeff with a huge clothesline and starts throwing Jeff into the ladder. They get in the ring, and Jeff kind of gets a little bit of advantage because he runs away and goes for broke kind of as Taker's getting back into the ring. He sort of launches the ladder into Taker's face. So Jeff constantly going back to the ladder. He heads in again with the ladder, but Taker pops it this time into his face. He takes Jeff outside again, drops him on the announce table, which you think an announce table spot's coming, but they kind of just leave it at that, which I thought was a little weird. Like he just kind of comes in, throws that little thin piece on him, and they just kind of leave it at that. They go back in the ring now, and Taker decides to continue on Jeff rather than climb. So they're kind of implying that he could have climbed right here, but he decides not to. I thought Taker had kind of a weak kick right here on the apron, but then he hits his apron leg drop with the ladder on top, which I thought that was a sick spot. Taker then eats the ladder in the corner as he's going to hit Jeff, but Jeff moves. Jeff hits a corkscrew he gets a little hope spot where he hits his little corkscrew moonsault deal. And then he punts Taker straight in the ball. So I love all the desperation from Jeff in this match. It's really, really good. All his desperation spots.
And it feels like strategy too. Like it doesn't feel like he's just like doing it for survival. It's like he came in knowing he was going to empty the kitchen sink and do all this stuff because it's a shot. So I like the way he does it as well as what he's doing.
Yeah, for sure. Like he, Like it's his strategy. Like he knows he's not going to go in and like do strikes or anything. He has to go for all these big crazy things and use the ladders and stuff. But he springs off the ladder to do a dive outside onto Taker. He does sort of his little diving senton thing he does outside the ring. Finally, he gets back in the ring. Jeff starts climbing. The crowd starts lining up, but Taker catches him this time, puts him in like he's going to go for the last ride. And but Jeff counters it into a Rana, which looked a little bit weak, and I just think it's like not a move that Taker takes that often, doing a Hurricane Rana. So it looked a little weak, but I did like the idea behind it. And Jeff starts his ascent again, and this is where we get a lot of the JR stuff. He tells him, climb your ass off, kid, and all this. Mm-hmm. And so the crowd's really lighting up at this point because this is where you think Jeff could do it. But then Taker gets a chair. He rocks him with the chair. He's on the ladder. He lays in some rib shots with the chair after Jeff falls down. He again goes for a last ride, but then Jeff grabs the chair this time and pops him. I thought that was a really cool spot. He basically takes, He kind of takes the chair while he's up in the last ride and kind of puts it between his legs and hits Taker in the head. So again, it's like they keep on teasing it that like you think this is when, you know, Jeff's going to be out of, okay, well, Taker just beat the fuck out of him with the chair. Like this is it. But then he gets every time Taker goes for a last ride, he can't hit it. And then he hits another sick ass chair shot to Taker's face and the crowd just loses on that one. He gets back up on the ladder. He's almost there. But again, Taker lays him with the chair and then tosses him by the throat, basically chokeslam him off the top of a ladder, and then Taker finally goes up and wins it. So that was a lot. Logan, why don't you start us off? Because I know this you love this match so and love Jeff Hardy. So how'd you feel about
that? I haven't really mentioned this up to this point in the show, but I don't know that this was the first Raw I ever watched live, but it's definitely one of the first that I ever watched, like, as it came on TV. So this is definitely my first, like, real memory of a great match that I watched, like, when it happened live. So this has always been a real big one for me. This was my first favorite match that I ever had just because JR does a really good job on commentary and really makes you believe that Jeff has any chance of winning this match because, you know, he's a guy that, you know, you never even think would be in a title match at this point. And like you said, he uses the ladder to his advantage because that's kind of why he challenged Taker to this kind of match because he knew he couldn't pin him, so he needed to use anything and everything he could do to possibly give himself a chance. Taker really dominates him, and at early point in the match, he could have climbed and grabbed the belt, but he goes out and just kind of keeps pounding on him a little bit. He wants to make sure he can't walk out of the arena. So I thought that was a good little part of storytelling, just kind of sticking to that point, making sure he knew that that Jeff wasn't going to walk out of the arena without a big old fight, and he was going to do as much as he could to make sure that wasn't going to happen. But I feel like they gave Jeff plenty of hope spots and just enough hope spots to where you could even have a little bit of a thought that he could possibly pull this off. And like I said, JR does a really good job on commentary, making you believe definitely towards the end when he's like, he's climbing that last time and he's like, make yourself famous, kid. So I really always bought into that. And that one always stuck in my mind. And this was a match that I always kind of sought out, but I never could find because I couldn't remember if it was on Raw or a pay-per-view or something like that. But it was one when the network came out. I immediately watched this Raw because I remembered how much I loved this match. He does a little springboard off the ladder at one point. I called it like a diving board dive, but I thought that was really awesome how he used the ladder as a little bit of a springboard. But yeah, the ending stretch with the JR commentary and Jeff kind of getting two big hope spots where he actually even almost grabs the strap of the belt to almost pull it off. But then Taker choke slams him, obviously. But yeah, I absolutely love this match. For the memory of all of it, I would give it 5 stars. But I know deep down that it's not a 5-star match. But I'll give it 4 for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big spot for Hardy. It's a career-making spot as a solo guy. Like a good chance for him to elevate. I like the start where he teases fucking with the bike just to get Taker kind of twisted around and then attacks him. I do think it's a little sluggish from there, though, until it really cranks up later, where Taker just kind of doing the bullying offense and kind of methodically working through it. But once Jeff hits the Will and the Wisp and kind of opens up the offensive throttles when it really picks up, and that's when JR gets fired up as well. The chair shot from Taker, like, he just fucking murders him with that first one. And then I love the counter with the to the last ride. That was a great tease. Probably the best part of the match until the finish. And then that other disgusting chair shot that Hardy just crushes him with. And everyone gets fired up. And that's when JR goes to hyperdrive into the finish and chokes Sam Jeff off the top. And I know we'll get into the post-match in a minute. I will say, being there live, like, this wasn't my favorite matches to see live. Just it had that feel of, it's what you want to feel when you get lost in the moment at a wrestling match with this underdog guy. It brought back some, like, low-key feelings of Foley and The Rock that I was at. Like, you didn't really expect the title change to happen, but holy shit, they did it. And, you know, Jeff's kind of in that role, the underdog guy that maybe is believable enough to win, but will they do it? And so you kind of get sucked in. And I definitely remember getting sucked in at the end, really thinking they were going to do it, feeling like we were going to see this huge moment. And they don't. And it was, like, a little deflating. But then once you let those feelings settle and you're like, oh, shit, we just saw, like, this awesome TV match that really was, like, a star-making performance. And in kind of both ways, like, you know, Taker's been up and down since, like, 96, but he hasn't had, like, a ton of classics still. Like, he's been better in 02 for sure. But this was, like, another one for his resume to show, like, he's continuously improving at this point, 10 years into his career, 12 years into his career. In the WWF, obviously even longer beyond that. So, like, it's a cool match for him, too. That said, when I watched this for the first time in a while, a couple years ago, we did the GWE list for greatest matches, I fully expected it to make my list, and it didn't. And my thought process held up watching it again. So I went 3.5, I think, for a Raw match. It's great. I think for a moment, those final moments are amazing. I just think the first half of the match lags a bit until that final, like, 5-minute stretch. So it's a damn good match. Again, methodical and slow in spots. The last 4 minutes to me were awesome. The teases were good. I think Hardy looks like a star. He hung in the whole way. The crowd is into it. It's a classic Raw moment. And kudos to Taker, too, for how he worked the match. But again, I just think if it has a better first portion, I think it really moves up the chain. But as is, it's more of a great final few minutes for me than anything else.
Yeah, I'm kind of on the same page as you. That was the biggest weakness for me, too, is that, like, Taker control segment I thought was a little bit bland. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought it had a nice hot opening, and the ending was obviously really good. But that whole spot where Taker's really in control, he just didn't do anything, especially compared to how many cool, like, creative spots they work in the beginning and end of the match. It's like, you know, the middle seemed kind of, like you said, it just seemed a little bit there at times. And I think it's not a super long match either for what they're trying to build. Right. It's not like this is 30 minutes. So you're kind of wasting a good chunk in the middle, just kind of meandering around, when I think you could have been doing something a little bit better to build up, you know, the story a little bit more. And I think it does hurt it. So, like you said, I'm with you guys. Like, in the moment, I was completely sucked in this. Like, you know, I was a little bit younger. I think I would have been like 12 at this point or something, but I was really into it. You know, JR had me believing he was going to get it. Obviously he doesn't. And, you know, some matches, I think that you kind of have memories like this for, every time you watch it, you can get kind of sucked back into it. And I feel like this one, I didn't quite get sucked back into it. And I think that's, you know, kind of a knock on the match a little bit, but it was still really good, really enjoyable. And like you said, JT, really good finish. I really liked the ending, some cool spots. So I went 3.5 as well, but still, for a Raw match, a Raw main event, and regardless, it is a star-making performance for Jeff. So we'll get into the post-match, which kind of continues with that. So an exhausted Taker, he rides back up the ramp as Jeff is trying to get to his feet. Jeff kind of grabs the mic. So he sees that Jeff is getting up. So he comes in, gives him another lash ride, because remember, he had made the claim that Jeff wasn't going to be able to stay in. Mm-hmm. So then he starts going back up the ramp again. Jeff comes back and gets the mic again and says, now the way he says it is really funny, a little funny. I know it's supposed to be kind of a serious moment, but he's like, "You haven't broken me." Like, just the way
it's
he
like
says
his voice cracks, like, so bad. Yeah. And he sounds like he's like crying, which he may have been. I mean, it was a rugged match. So maybe he wasn't enough, but yeah, he sounds like he's like, it doesn't help the emo stuff that they have shown between them and Lita for sure.
Yeah, so he kind of, that is a little bit goofy, but it still kind of lands in. So Taker comes back in. You think Taker is going to beat the fuck out of him again, but then he kind of pats him on the head and raises his hand and the crowd pops to that. So kind of Taker, like Logan said a minute ago, they're kind of pushing a little bit like where Taker's still sort of the bully, but like here he's given, you know, if he's really a full heel, he would just, you know, give him another lash ride and tell him to fuck off. But instead, he kind of at least gives him a little respect nod. And so definitely gives, you know, gives Jeff the nod here. And it definitely puts Jeff over. And I think it at least establishes that Jeff could be something as a single star as he breaks away from the Hardys, which I think is probably one of the main things they were accomplishing. I think they did a pretty good job of it. But that will wrap up Raw. Overall, I thought, like we kind of talked about, maybe the main event is not, you know, up to the lofty expectations that your memory would have, which is hard to live up to. But it's still great, especially for TV, and definitely engaging storytelling throughout the entire show, not just the match, but the way they built up throughout the show and even last week. And I thought with a few other kind of notable things happening, we had the pretty good opener with Flair and Brock and just the novelty of that. You get NWO kind of mentioning that Triple H is going to join them, which is kind of an interesting moment. So with all that and then the great main event, I ended up going 6 out of 10 on this one. What did you think, JT?
Yeah, I thought it was a really good episode. Like you said, you get the Flair Brock match to start, and then this really iconic ladder match. That's one of the better Raw moments of this era to close. Plus some good stuff in between. The show for me flew by. I liked that anchor tag match too. That kind of was like a make or break, right? If the show was going to kind of pop up or just be like a one match show. I thought some of the promo stuff was good. I thought we had good progression in all the angles. RVD and Brock, we moved that forward. I thought Booker and Goldust, we had a bunch of them throughout the show. Even the NWO stuff, as goofy as it's been, like tonight wasn't too bad with that, you know, Michaels and stuff promo with the teaser Triple H. I went 6.5. I think it's a very good Raw. I think it's a memorable Raw. It's one that's always looked upon fondly from this era, and I think it holds up.
Logan?
Maybe Logan didn't enjoy it as much. You want me, Logan?
Logan? Are you crying like Jeff Hardy? And you know, at the beauty of that ladder match?
I'm still standing.
You haven't broken me.
It would have been better if he did sing Elton John in there.
Oh, I was on mute, damn it. I'm sorry.
For how long? We called you out?
I guess I've been on mute for a while. I don't know. Right. But I would go 7 out of 10, I think. I like that main event a little bit more than I think maybe you guys did. But it's mostly because of I remember the memory of watching it the first time was just so amazing. And that really strong opener with Flair and Lesnar. But yeah, a lot of good stuff in between. But I'd go 7 out of 10. I really like this episode of Raw. Yeah.
Very good. Yeah, it was extremely good. And so we'll head into SmackDown. And something that I don't think any of us really realized, but this is a pretty memorable SmackDown. So this would be the July 4th, 2002 SmackDown in Boston. And so this is kind of a pretty well-known episode of Raw. TV from this era, too. Mm-hmm. And I know we had spoke before, like, not remembering that these two shows were, you know, within the same week. Because they're both kind of known for different stuff. But it just didn't connect that it was in the same week that these two shows were like back to back like this, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, I was surprised. I mean, I didn't realize that until I went to go put on SmackDown. And this is a very memorable one. I remember, like I said, I was working retail at the time. So I worked a lot at nights and I'd usually record Raw or SmackDown, depending on if I was working. But I can't say I always went back to watch them. So I actually wasn't like super dialed in during the stretch. I'd catch what I could, but this was definitely one I remember recording and watching back. And, because it was cool that I was on the holiday, it was on July 4th. So that part of it was really neat. And yeah, it's ended up surprising me that these two were the same week and, both are very memorable in their own right. So we'll get into it.
Yeah. So we start with a recap of Edge's storyline over the past couple of months with Jericho beating him, injuring his shoulder or his arm or whatever, and then Jericho hitting him with a chair on the stairs, which kind of led to him being out for a little while, but then he made his return recently. We start off, since it is the 4th of July, they actually do the national anthem. Lillian Garcia starts to sing it, but she is interrupted by Lance Storm with his group of angry Canadians. And immediately I'm thinking, like, man, this is such a good idea, because they've been trying this out. They've been slowly building this kind of Canadian anti-American stable with, Storm kind of adding to his ranks and sort of preaching his pro-Canadian anti-American gospel to these guys. And so I thought this was a perfect moment to, like, establish them, like, mm-hmm. to give them this spot and establish them. So Christian asks if they know why they're celebrating, because if so, they're... because Americans probably think that the Independence Day is when you celebrate that Will Smith beat the aliens, which I thought was a great line. Storm says it was founded as colonies and then they turned on Britain and they have no gratitude for Britain, which is absurd. And he says now America takes its hostilities out on the rest of the world. And they start to get asshole chants. So they're obviously getting, like, nuclear heat for this, interrupting mm-hmm. the national anthem on the 4th of July. He calls out America for losing in Vietnam, which was quite a blow. He says America doesn't listen to the world. And then finally, they let Tess speak last. He doesn't say a whole lot, probably for the best. And he adds in that the world hates America, and so do they. And then they all say that America sucks. So good opening heel promo to finally establish them as a heel faction by crapping on the national anthem on the 4th of July, the anti-American Canadians.
I thought it was great. Yeah, I thought it was really good. I like the touch of having Lillian do the national anthem like she always kind of did, and she crushes it always. I mean, she was great doing it, and it was July 4th. Perfect mm-hmm. timing to have them interrupt and cut them off to build the heat. So I thought that was really, really good. Christian needs a haircut, like, bad. His hair is, like, out of control. But I thought Storm was just on fire here. Like, it might be one of his greatest promos of all time. Like, mm-hmm. he was really feeling it and just on fire. You could tell he's been waiting for the kind of, like, a chance like this that he cashes in. So, yeah, I thought it was really, really well done. It came together fast, and Tess is the muscle. It was, like, a pretty good choice. He's got nothing else going on. Let Storm and Christian do the talking and the working, and Tess can just back him up. So far it's coming together nicely. I don't think we can forget too where we were in American history at this point. Like, we're less than a year from 9/11. So, like, it's still a mm-hmm. lot of the, you know, Americana and jingoisms, like, pretty hot still at this point. So this was going to be, like, very natural heat for them to get, and they pile it on. Also, by the way, in the open, Beautiful People, still a banger of a SmackDown open. It's I got kind of fired up watching that open.
Yeah, I love the Christian history lesson he gives us, and how he calls out the youths of America for yes. not really knowing what Independence Day was about. And I really like that Storm kind of painted America as the bad guys in the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. I thought that was an interesting tactic that I don't think I've ever seen. But yeah, they do the whole thing where they call out America for going to war with everybody, and he talks about all the different wars that we've gotten in. And like Jake said, he points out that we lost Vietnam and really drives that home. But yeah, I think if Tess hadn't talked, it would have been just as good, but he added a little bit at the end, I guess.
Yeah, they were smart by only giving him like a couple lines to say, just to hammer it home at the end, which is a good use of them. But yeah, another thing is, like, they are in desperate need of, like, tag teams, you know, and so this could easily, you know, shore up the tag ranks a little bit to have this, you know, like you mentioned, JT, to have, you know, Storm and Christian is a pretty good tag team, and you could have Test on the outside, so, because they are in desperate need of some, you know, legitimate tag teams.
I think it's funny though how they do, some of these guys always fall back to the tag, like they try and do something solo and it just always comes back to mm-hmm. tag teams, like we talked about with Bubba earlier. Now kind of the same with Christian, like they try and give these guys pushes and then just after a few months give up and just go put them back in a tag team.
Same with Billy Gunn too. We'll talk about him later.
Mm-hmm. But, well, luckily for America, the savior of America is coming to confront these anti-American ingrates, and that is Rikishi. So he comes out and he is going to be facing Storm, which they say is actually was a scheduled match regardless. It just wasn't supposed to, you know, wasn't necessarily supposed to open the show or whatever. But then Storm came out and started trashing America. Rikishi came out now. So they go right into the match. Rikishi controls. He really controls a good portion of the match. Rikishi kind of has like the SmackDown version of Bubba where it's like, They don't really do much with him, but he always looks pretty good in his matches. Mm-hmm. Like, they always let him get a lot of offense and look pretty good and protect him a little bit. So he controls most of this until he misses. He does a deal where he goes to do his, like, corner butt bump, and Storm moves. So he hits his ass in the corner, and then Storm hits an enziguri. But Rikishi gets back on top. He does this. I was so surprised because he does this spot, because I have to watch a lot of Rikishi. He wrestles like every week on SmackDown, and he always does that spot where he goes to sit on the guy, and like 99% of the time the guy moves and he just falls on his ass, and then finally he hits it here. So I was shocked to see him actually hit that move on Storm. So he goes back up to hit Storm, and I also pop for Taz saying, look at that big Keista. So I pop for that. The Canadians get up on the apron. They distract, and Christian distracts the ref, and then Tess comes up and hits Rikishi with a nice kick. He had some good extension on that kick. I thought it was a pretty impressive kick, which allows Storm to pick up the win. It was a pretty basic match. Like I said, Rikishi controlled most of it, with Storm getting in a few bits of offense, but it really is just to establish the heel faction that they're going to, you know, they're going to use their heel tactics to win. So it's a match, a star and a half, but it served this purpose of, giving the anti-Americans, the Canadians, a good win on their first kind of official outing. So star and a half for me. What'd you think, Logan?
Yeah, I went a star and a half as well. And I made the note that Rikishi used his power and ass-based offense to kind of dominate most of the match. So and Storm... Yeah, his keys to offense, I guess. Taz really loves Rikishi's ass and talking about it all the time, so he mentions it a lot when he's in matches. But, Storm's only real offense is kind of when he gets a few underhanded little shots in. But, the ref distraction at the end allows Tess to hit the big boot. I feel like Tess's big boot is one of those, like, underrated finishing moves that, like, isn't really talked about that much. But his boot is really awesome when he hits it really mm-hmm. flush. So, I was a fan of this match, and I thought it was a good way to kind of start building the anti-American faction they got going.
Or the anti-American mob, as Cole calls them. It was it was fine. This is like such a 2002 match. But yeah, it was good. Yeah. I mean, Rikishi does get a lot of offense, and I liked the finish. I thought it was fine, because just really establishing this group as heels with the promo and the cheating. And I mean, you know, these guys have not been getting much of a push, and here they are jumpstarting them, and they gave them a good... Like, this all-in had to be close to 15, 20 minutes of the opening of a big holiday mm-hmm. show. So it's like they're really in on them. Like, this is like a good show of confidence to let them run the whole opening segment pretty much and first match on a big edition of SmackDown. So,
yeah, for context, the last thing that Christian was up to is where he was like throwing tantrums during his matches. So that's, you know, that's where he was. So yeah. You can't really... Can't really go much lower than that. So
done shit really since the whole like immunity stuff at the end of 01, and Storm really hasn't done much either. Honestly, I mean, ever since the invasion ended, so they really took three pretty cold guys and fired them back up pretty quick.
They were all betting on Mark Henry's feats of strength.
Yeah, that's all they did. And then Storm was like a utility guy that they would throw out when they needed a heel to be in a match, like a fill in a tag match. But yeah, good for them. We get a recap of John Cena's debut last week with Kurt, which was a great moment. And then we see that Stacy knocks on the locker room door. I want to say it was it Mark Henry that answered the door at first? And he's like, I'm gonna go get him. Yeah, and he's like, I'm gonna go get him. And then Cena comes out. He is in Celtic colors, and Stacy says that Vince wants to see him. We then head to the ring, and we're gonna
Stacy, by the way, was like, I fucking him as well.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
It's a common trope on here is that Vince is like the creepy boss, but then Stacy's into all these hot rookies, and Vince gets kind of pissed off about it. It's like an ongoing SmackDown storyline because she's kind of into Orton too, but. We head to this next tag match, which is going to be Batista and Reverend Devon versus Randy Orton and Val Venus. Val is the babyface buddy who just tags along with whoever the face is when they need a partner. My first note when Reverend Devon and Batista come out is that Batista is fucking huge. He's gigantic.
That's my first sentence right here. Batista is fucking massive. And he was slim, too. Like, he wasn't bulked. Like, he's really, like, kind of skinny in a way. Like he's just really jacked. Just an impressive-looking human when he comes out here.
Not even a human. He doesn't look bloated. Yeah, he doesn't look bloated or anything. He just looks ripped, like, man. And it made me think, like, seeing him like that, it's like they're really starting to go back to, you know, with Brock, and now obviously, you know, they're moving Batista up a little bit. Like, he's not getting a huge push, but he's, you know, he's actually wrestling now. But they're kind of going back to, like, these Hoss sort of heel guys, like Batista, Brock, which hadn't really been, you know, I know historically is kind of something they're known for, but in this era, like in the years preceding it, it's not really something that they had relied on too much. So it kind of is a bit of, you know, them going back to, I guess, what got them to the dance, sort of, by going back to these big jacked up heel guys. So, I don't know, I'm just crossed my mind seeing Batista come out looking massive. But Val starts off the match. He has to go for the legs to have any effect on Batista, but Batista just levels him. Batista kind of working a similar style that Brock does, where he's just like, you know, guys are trying to, he just has such a power advantage that they can't handle him. Orton comes in. He starts getting worked over by Devon. So he tags in Val. Val comes in hot on the Reverend, but then he gets hit with Devon, hits his little spin out powerbomb thing. Devon actually hits a blind tag, which allows Batista to come in. And this was the highlight of the match. Batista hits like a, I guess it's like a fireman carry roll thing. And it looked fluid as shit. It looked great. And so that looked really awesome. And then Orton comes in. He tries to get do a crossbody on Batista. He gets some killer height on it, but he misses. And then Batista finishes him off with a huge spine buster. I thought this was a good high-energy tag, and it clearly had a goal of showcasing both of the rookie guys. The other two veterans were just kind of in there to keep everything together because you had Orton, even though he loses, he gets to show off that crossbody and just sort of his athleticism, and definitely Batista because he just looked dominant. And that fireman carry roll thing that he did looked badass. So I went 2 stars on this one. What'd you think, JT?
I like Devon's theme. I feel like the gimmick is kind of been unfairly treated as time. You know, I feel like it actually is a pretty good gimmick for him. And I think at the time it felt like he got kind of hosed and Bubba got the better push. But looking back, like, I think the Devon gimmick is really good. And I kind of like him better as a de facto manager. Like, I know he's working here, but I think they figured it out like a month in that it shouldn't be him wrestling with Batista as the backup. It should be Batista in the ring and Devon as his mouthpiece that occasionally works with him too, which is a much better way to go about it. But just a crazy match, you know, too, when you look at it. And an odd use of Val. Taz keeps talking about like Batista's snap on offense, and I think that sums up his offense really, really well. I also thought Orton looked pretty smooth and had some flashes here. The crowd is into him. He's just so lean and skinny. You know, I don't know if we needed a Val hot tag, but whatever. No. Like, and him and Devon kind of get a run. Like, let's just get Batista and Orton. Like, we don't really need them. But, like, Batista has star written all over him. I mean, he has such a presence. And it's going to be curious to see how he evolves. Because I think there is a time eventually where folks felt like he was just kind of a lumbering goof in the ring before he really breaks out, like maybe like 04-ish. So I'm curious to see how he progresses here. But he looks amazing. And if you're watching this, you would think Orton has a solid like upper mid-card face potential and Batista is like megastar potential. Like if when you look at this, that's how you would probably line these guys up. And he just murders Orton with that spine buster. So I thought this was great. I thought Batista looked awesome, kind of blended the vets of the future. I went 2 3/4, mainly because of Batista's offense. I thought he was so good, and I really, really enjoyed this match. And honestly, it's as good of a use for Val and Devon as you can get. Like, let them help these young guys get over and help them work matches. Like, that's kind of how they should be used, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I went 2 1/4. Yeah, I really thought Batista looked impressive. And y'all were talking about how jacked he was. My mom was actually over at our house when I was watching this show, and she talked about how gross his traps were. And I was like, yeah, that him and Brock had those big old traps during this this time period. So, but I just thought that was a funny comment that y'all brought that up. But Batista does a couple of clotheslines on Val, and he absolutely wrecks him with both of them, especially the first one he hits. It's right when he gets in the match at first, and he just wrecks Val with the clothesline. But I always think it's weird seeing Batista and Orton on different sides, as we know what they're going to end up being eventually. But it's kind of weird seeing them both this early kind of being on opposite sides of the ring. Orton already has his dropkick down. His dropkick's one of the best in the business, so it looks real smooth. And like JT said, he's real smooth in the ring, and that crossbody he hits, he gets some major height on it, so that's always impressive to look at. But yeah, the spine buster for the win was awesome, and Batista looked really great in this match, so I really liked it.
It's so interesting to see Randy Orton work in this like white meat baby face, like, you know, it's kind of, I don't know, it's interesting to watch as I've been watching these like rookie Randy Orton come in and it's like a little baby face doing his big crossbody and stuff.
So skinny.
Like he would spend the majority of his career being like this methodical kind of heel, and just to see him being this like high energy, like, you know. It's very interesting, but I agree on Reverend Devon too. I think once they sort of got away from the collection plate and really going, you know, almost taking the gimmick way too seriously, not seriously, but, you know, like literally, I guess you could say. And now he's kind of just, you know, he's got Batista and he's sort of just following him around. I think it works a lot better. So yeah, I thought this was a good use of them on this show.
Even Adam Cole told Randy Orton to work on his upper body after this one.
I mean, look at Batista.
Looks like fucking Tony Jones out there, you know.
I was saying, was your Adam Cole from Arkansas there, Jake?
So continuing the trend that I mentioned earlier. So now Jericho is in Vince's office bitching and complaining about Edge. And he says, Vince says that he'll get Edge at Vengeance. And then Cena comes in and Vince says that he's impressed because Cena has, you know, done what Vince said he wanted, ruthless aggression, etc. Jericho said that he's not impressed. And he asked what kind of ruthless aggression he has. And then to respond, Cena slaps the shit out of him. And it was a really good slap. He just really nailed him. So really great stuff, and continues to show that Cena is like not afraid to challenge these veteran guys. So I really enjoyed this. It was a good way. And obviously kind of, and so Jericho's furious. They go to a break and then Jericho comes back. He's furious and he wants Cena tonight. And so they sort of set up that for later on tonight. So another big match gets thrown in for, on the show, but I love the segment. Great slap.
Yeah, this is really good. You know, Jericho just being so angry, yelling at Vince, and Edge is back and all this other stuff. And he gets a match of Edge of Vengeance. That's a big match for Vengeance, like I said. And then Cena just coming in and, you know, Vince puts him over. He likes his ruthless aggression. He says it's from the Boston area. And then just Cena just slapping the shit out of him. Big night for these young stars. Like, they're going all in on SmackDown, on the future, and Raw with Brock. I mean, just think since Mania, when you think long term, looking back at hindsight, within 3 months of Mania, they've debuted John Cena, Brock Lesnar, Randy Orton, and Batista. It's like insane to look back at, you know?
I wonder if like Austin leaving too made Vince really like, you know, double down on the young guys. And he's like, you know, like really commit to him and be like, okay, now I really want to, you know, elevate these guys. Cause I can't rely on my, you know, the guys who have been the cornerstones with Rock, you know, their Rock's kind of fading and Stone Cold left and stuff. I wonder if that influenced him at all.
And even giving some like bigger spots to these more experienced guys that have kind of been around a while, like Booker and RVD and even Jeff on the episode of Raw, you know, just kind of giving some newer guys some shots at like the top of the card and kind of giving them a little bit more of an elevated role. Yeah, I definitely think Austin leaving caused him to kind of take a step back and kind of see like, I really need to start building for the future because these guys like Rock and Austin aren't always going to be here.
This is what they've been waiting for, right? Because for years they dreamed of doing this developmental thing, and they always talked about it and talked about it and talked about it. Like Jim Ross, that was like his main goal, was to build a developmental system, and they kind of had the Funkin' Dojo stuff in like 98 99, and then they finally established like OVW and you know, started to bring in this young talent where they wanted to develop the house style and bring them up and create their own stars instead of relying on others. And this starts, that method of how they build their roster for the next 5 to 6 years, for better or worse. But I think this was always a goal of theirs. So I think that also is a big piece of it. Like, these were guys you heard about, for a year or so. And there are others too, right? Like Shelton Benjamin, Charlie Haas, and a few others. But these are all guys you heard a ton about in 01 and 02. You heard about Prototype. You heard about Leviathan. You heard about, Brock Lesnar. So these are all dudes that were talked up quite a bit when you would read the different, and there are other ones too that don't panel, right? Ron H.O. Waterman and guys like that you heard a ton about too that never really made it. But this was something they had tried for a long time and finally sorted it out.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think it'll be something to watch as we see these guys, these OVW guys, come through and sort of compare and contrast to how you see guys come out of NXT now and the way that they're treated or presented, in this era compared to how they are now and how it kind of pans out for all of them. I guess we kind of know, but but anyway. So continue on. Angle, they cuts a promo backstage. He speaks about his title match tonight. He says that he is the poster boy for Ruthless Aggression. Says last week, the reason he had so much trouble with John Cena is because he actually had the flu, in case you didn't know. But tonight he will become the champ. He shows footage of him pinning Taker and making Hogan tap to remind us how good he is. He said he's an American hero, and so he should win on the 4th. And that he called Taker a badass. I thought at first he called Taker a fat ass, which I thought would have been really funny if we'd have called him a fat ass. But I realized he said badass at first. But basically, this was just him hyping the title match tonight. He was very confident. Really good promo from Kurt, just putting himself over. He spent a lot of time in the past few months like getting other people over. So it's nice to see them kind of heating him back up and putting him, in a title match, getting some wins, making Hogan tap. Like, you could tell they're trying to elevate him back up to sort of main event status. And I thought it was a good promo. He was very confident going into his title match.
Yeah, he's awesome. Great, great heel angle stuff. Go ahead, Luke.
Yeah, Angle during this period is at the top of his game. I mean, he's at the top of his his goof, playing kind of a goof in the backstage and in his promos, kind of talking himself up. But he's getting real intense in the ring, and he's always awesome in his matches. So yeah, Kurt during this period and for like the next year and a half is really good.
So we cut to Billy and Chuck, who are backstage. They're eating hot dogs. Rico comes in and scolds them for eating the hot dogs, saying they're disgusting. He flings the hot dog around, and the hot dog breaks. And he tells them that they have Hogan and Edge tonight, and so they need to get ready because this is a big match. So obviously doing the some innuendo with Billy and Chuck and Rico flinging hot dogs around. But anyway, so that will lead us to our big tag title match. We have Hogan and Edge, who have recently become buddies, and they're going to be facing champions Billy and Chuck. Touch I noticed is that Hogan comes out to Real American for obvious reasons.
Yes.
And I was really excited because I have to hear that terrible dub that they play on the network for Hogan, the Voodoo Child, like Great Value Voodoo Child. He's waving the flag. The crowd is super lit. So definitely some good energy going into this.
And it's cool they did the Real American, because that's something I feel like you would talk about, like, oh, 4th of July, they should do it, and then they don't do it. And it was really cool that they just did it, that he comes out, the red and yellow, he's got Real American. Like, it was super fitting. It felt old school. It felt like something they would have done in, like, 1985 or whatever. So it was really cool they went for it. Also, they've been showing these classic rock moments throughout the night, but I think none of them are all that classic. They're all from like the last year.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah, because they're hyping up that Rock is officially, even though he was at King of the Ring and whatever, that his official return will be July 11th, which would be next week. Mm-hmm. So we head into this one. We start off with Chuck and Hogan to start, and with Hogan winning the test of strength.
Yes. What a mismatch.
Like, what is the Hulk Hogan versus Billy and Chuck? Like, it's so 02. It's great. It's such a weird year in history. It's so
weird. It's so, and like, this is such a humbling year for, I know he wins the title and stuff, but like, he just tapped Angle. Like you said, now he's locking up with Chuck here on SmackDown. Yeah. Yeah. It's very, him, having the, I guess put Ezekiel aside. But so the Chuck starts clubbing him. So here we go again. So he's getting clubbed by Chuck. he turns his back. Chuck turns his back and pays for it. Edge gets tagged in and he finds himself in peril. We get some good quick tags from the champs. And one thing I noticed in this match, their title run has been very tepid, mainly because they have no competition. Mm-hmm. But I definitely felt Billy and Chuck stepped their game up in this match, like right from the get go. Like they're doing the quick tags, they're working over Edge until finally Edge ducks, and then Rico cracks Billy with a kick on accident. But Billy manages to come back from that and bulldog Edge on the steps. Billy and Chuck continue to control Edge, so they're definitely doing a really long control sequence on Edge. Edge finally hits a counter, allowing a hot tag to Hogan as the crowd is fully behind them at this point. So they built this. They did a really good job knowing the crowd is super, you know, wanting to see, you know, Hogan coming out to Real America. The crowd is fully behind the face team. And so they really build up the hot tag to Hogan, which was pretty smart. Chuck cuts off the big leg with a super kick, which again is kind of an interesting spot. We get Chuck cutting off the big leg, but Hogan fights off both of them and tags Edge. We get some great fire from Edge as he comes in until Rico manages to trip him, which cuts off his momentum a little bit. But then Hogan goes out and neutralizes Rico. We end up with Billy and Edge in the ring. Edge hits a spear, but then Chuck pulls Edge out on the pin, which was a great near fall. I thought that was going to be it right there. Edge hits the leg drop of his own finally, and then Hogan comes in, he hits the leg drop, and they get the pin and win the titles to a huge reaction. I really enjoyed this match. I thought it was really a great fluid tag match. Everybody's hitting their spots. I thought Billy and Chuck really went up a gear. It's easily the best that they've looked since I started doing the pod. Like I said, there were some really great near falls where you thought that was going to be it, especially like Edge's spear. Just I love the way that the heels constantly kept cutting them off and then until mm-hmm. they were finally able to do it. Them both hitting the leg drop was a cool moment. The crowd was super into it. I really enjoyed this. I went 3.5 on it. I thought this was a really I think I kind of thought back to it and I remembered it being like a good moment, them winning the titles and stuff on 4th of July, but I didn't really remember much about the match, and the match kind of pleasantly surprised me for this. Smart to have Edge, you know, do most of the heavy lifting in the ring and selling and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, good stuff. I went 3.5. What'd you think of this one, Logan?
Yeah, I went 3. Like y'all said, I really love that they played a real American to bring him out because the crowd was really into the Americana stuff that they had going all night. So they really popped for that one. And they're super behind Hogan. They were chanting for Hogan the whole match whenever he wasn't in. And they were going wild for whenever he was in the match. I made the note that these aren't quite the jobber teams that Billy and Chuck are used to. So they, like you said, they really had to bring their A game so because they're not facing freaking Valboski and insert tag team partner here. So, like you said, I really thought Billy and Chuck brought their end of this tag team match. And I feel like they're not one of the greatest tag teams of all time or anything like that, but I think they're a really good team. And I feel like they don't get what they really kind of deserve as a team just because they were in this era where there weren't many tag teams that they could really face or have really good matches with. So I think they're kind of an overlooked tag team in the history of the company. But I mentioned that super kick that Chuck hits to kind of cut off the leg drop at one point. I thought that was a pretty awesome super kick he hit. But when Rico kind of gets involved, Hogan goes out and drops him on his balls on the guardrail. I thought that was a pretty funny spot, and Rico sold it really well. But Edge and Hogan hit the double big boot and they both hit their own leg drops and win the match. So yeah, I really, really enjoyed this one. And Edge and Hogan are a real interesting team for this time period.
It, again, so random. I love the absurdity of like fucking Real American, which is, you know, in our tournament board, our like the most iconic wrestling theme of all time. And then Hogan comes to the ring, arguably still, you know, at this point, probably the greatest wrestler, most recognized wrestler of all time, biggest wrestler of all time, gets to the ring, and then fucking Billy and Chuck come out after that with their theme. It goes so ridiculous in a good way. The crowd's really buzzing, and Hogan's playing it up. You could tell this feels like a big deal, like a big match. And it felt a little bit like an old-school Science Man event match with Hogan and his buddy mm-hmm. against the tag champs. So in a mm-hmm. way, you could think it was headed for like a DQ or something screwy, you know? It feels like it's just going that way, like Hogan and Tugboat versus Rhythm and Blues, or Hogan and Beefcake versus the Brainbuster. You know, like it just felt like Hogan and Buddy against regarded tag team. But Billy and Chuck did look good here. Like, that belly-to-belly mm-hmm. by Billy was really nice. The crowd really fired up. They're really behind Hogan and Edge. They explode for the hot tag as Hogan just dusts the champ. The champs. Edge gets a tag. You know, he's cutting through both guys. They clear out Rico. You get the switcheroo for the tease, which I thought was well done, which makes you think Hogan and Edge kind of may have missed the window and they're not going to change the belts, but then you get the finish, which is really perfect booking. Like, 100% kudos to them for going through with this. It's a classic moment that's kind of gotten forgotten at the time, but, man, the pop is great. It's a feel-good moment. It's a holiday. Edge, you know, is a guy that he always looked up to Hogan as a kid, so it's like you feel good for him. Like, he just came back off that little injury, and it's a big step forward for his career, and he gets to be out there with Hulk Hogan with Real American blaring, posing on 4th of July. It's like, it's just a really cool atmosphere for the whole thing. I'm so happy they went through with it and delivered this moment. So I went 3 stars, and to me it's just insane, like we've talked about, that it happened the same week as it, because everyone remembers the Jeff Hardy thing. And those two moments were on the same week of WWE TV. Like, that's just nuts to me. And this one just gets overshadowed by it. And this is just such a fun moment.
And the thing, too, is, like, you don't even have this, like, maybe, like, sour taste in your mouth after, like, oh, man, these tag champs just got fed to Hogan or whatever, because they were doing jack shit before. So it's not like, yeah. Like, Billy and Chuck are probably better off losing the title so they can kind of reset, because they're doing... You know, the last thing they did was, like, feuding with, you know, Rikishi, who was teaming with their own manager in that dumbass thing they did. So it's like they're probably better off just losing it and sort of resetting. So you don't even have to be like, oh, well, these poor guys got fed to Hogan or whatever for, you know, so they can have this moment. Like, even that is not bad. It's probably better off for them. And they look great in the match. So it's, like, good all around, even for them. So, yeah, it was awesome. I really enjoyed that match more than I thought I would. But, All right, so we head to the match that was set up earlier tonight, Chris Jericho versus Cena. Definitely shades of the match that we got last week with Cena and Angle. Jericho comes in pissed, obviously, because Cena slapped the shit out of him. But Cena is scrappy, and he's trying to fight through. So basically, Jericho's coming after him, and he can't quite get Cena in anything he wants to, because Cena's kind of working his way out of it. So Jericho gets kind of frustrated. He goes straight for the announce table. But then, again, kind of a weird spot again where they kind of go for the announce table, but then he rolls Cena back in. And then as they go back in, Cena nails him with a drop kick, a midair drop kick, as Jericho's coming off the top rope. So that kind of gives him a hope spot, as Jericho's kind of gotten most of the offense, and he unloads again with a clothesline. Jericho is able to grab the walls, but Cena counters to a roll-up in a really cool spot. Jericho dodges in the corner as Cena's come after him, and he hits his, one of his main spots, which is the bulldog. He goes for a lion salt, but he does the thing where he lands on his feet instead. But then Cena meets him and gives him a spine buster. Jericho then manages to hit a move called the flashback, which I'm not super familiar with. It was almost kind of like a little bit like Dolph Ziggler's like zigzag move, where he kind of pulls him from the back.
And... Yeah, it was basically like a lung blower, which was starting to really pick up steam around this time with the Ring of Honor. I think it was you. I know John Walters ends up using it, and I think it was starting to become a move during that time that was kind of gaining popularity in the indie scene.
Yeah, and so he kind of beats him with that, which was a little surprising, with his foot on the ropes, of course, just for the added leverage and a little heelishness. I thought this was a well-done match. I thought it was a pretty good story of, like, him, Jericho coming in pissed off, but he can't quite get the upper hand on Cena because, you know, I guess Cena's a little bit better than he expected, and Cena showing how resourceful he is, similar to how he did in the Kurt match and how resilient he is. And then, you know, the heel veteran has to eventually go to something a little bit underhand and use the ropes to get an advantage. Thought that was pretty good. It very reminiscent of the match he had with Angle, just maybe not quite the moment, because it wasn't like a shock or a surprise for him to come out. But as a match, it was kind of, I think, similarly done. Same sort of story they were going for. And it does let Jericho get a win, which Jericho hasn't got a ton of wins on TV lately. Uh-huh. And then let Cena look good in the process. So pretty good all around, and continues to show that Cena can hang with these these stars. So I went 3 on it. I enjoyed this one. JT, what'd you think?
Yeah, man, what a big episode this is. I mean, honestly, yeah. When you look at it, another historical match here. John Cena's second match, but this is the one I think more people probably remember. Cena with the Jericho rock theme seems so absurd when it comes out. I like Jericho here, very angry and aggressive and you know, just not happy. Taz with strong gun commentary giving Cena's background. I like Cena, how he looked here, like resourceful and prepped as well, kind of countering a lot of offense and doesn't look over his skis at all, doesn't look green. Like we talked about Chris Nowinski on Raw and like how he kind of looked it over his head, but like Cena here does not look that way at all. Looks like he's prepared, ready to be out there. I like the flurry of deer falls into the finish. And honestly, this caught me off guard. I remember the match where Cena beats him and I thought I was here for some reason. So I actually was surprised when Jericho won. And then Cena beats him up after the match, which is interesting. But it was solid. It was professional. It was a smooth match. Cena looked good. And Jericho, such a selfless pro, just made Cena look great. Another fun moment in a night of them. And Cena comes close and looks strong. The future is really creeping in. Just completely filled with memorable moments on this episode. So I went 2.5. I thought it was a very good, very straightforward match. And it made Cena look like someone who's going to be something.
Yeah, absolutely. I really enjoyed the Angle Cena match from the week before. I went 2.5 as well on this one. This one was a little less than that one, but it was still a strong contest for Cena coming out of the gate. And yeah, like JT said, he looks like he's already kind of already in the mode where he can really go with some of these more experienced guys. I love the resilience that Cena kind of shows throughout the match. And yeah, Jericho winning with the flashback was a little strange to me too, but I remember this kind of being like an alternate finisher that he would hit every now and then. I think he tried to make it his finisher in like late 01 for just a little bit, but you know, he would go back to the Lion Salt and the Walls of Jericho and all that. But yeah, it's kind of an alternate finisher that he brings out every now and then. But it was also really weird seeing these guys face off this early in Cena's career, because you know, they face each other a ton of times in the future. Real interesting match. I really like Cena to start out. I didn't realize he was this hot coming out of the gates, but yeah, I went 2.5.
Yeah, good stuff. And they remind us here with another video package that that Rey Mysterio is going to be coming soon. And then, like you said earlier, JT, they give us more of The Rock, like hyping up that The Rock is going to be coming back.
And a classic Rock moment from December 6th, 2001.
Classic. Of course. But then we get Cole and Taz. They kind of go to them at the announce table. They discuss Triple H. And I thought they brought up an interesting wrinkle here to this, as they're kind of debating, like, you know, is HBK being honest? Triple H really going to go? And they bring up a good point that Triple H is a SmackDown guy. And to join AEW, you'd have to move over to Raw, which I think is an interesting caveat. And it made sense for them to bring it up. And then we had, we go backstage now. We get, so actually, we get a recap of the Thongathon that had recently
take a shot,
that weekend. There's the Thongathon. And Tori won, as we're told, and Stacy is particularly upset because she says that the only reason that she won is because she is sleeping with Maven, and Maven was one of the judges. And Tori says that at least she isn't sleeping with the boss. So some drama building between
these
two. And
then, yeah, King was singing the Miss America song as the catalyst.
Yeah, as they're fighting. Yeah, so we have some fallout from the Thongathon. Did we head to anything to add on this before we head to the trailer, guys?
No, not really.
No, yeah.
The big restaurant at Times Square for, though. This is what they're using it for. So who knows what's going on up in Niagara Falls if this is what's happening here.
Oh, man. If I could be a fly on the wall at WWE Niagara Falls. So good. Now we
bikini contest.
So now we head to Jamie Noble and Nydia on location, as Jamie Noble, now that he is champion, Cruiserweight champion, he is able to buy a new trailer. And so I did note throughout this entire thing that growing up in the South, that this is almost a little too real for me. Like, I feel like I've known Jamie Nobles and Nydias in my life, people who are like a little bit too similar to this, but they're like real people, not wrestling characters. So that was a little disturbing for me personally. He says that he inherited it from his Aunt Edna. He says it's got running water, a full-size bed. but it's basically just them christening their new trailer, and that they're going to have all these amenities like running water. I enjoy them. I don't know. They crack me up. I love anytime Jamie Noble speaks, I'm just like, I'm all there for it. Just the way he speaks is incredible to me. And it kind of, to me, it built the characters too. Like, mm-hmm. It was cool to see him do this on location. It almost had like an old school, like, vignette feel, like a, you know, yes. late 80s or early 90s right. sort of.
You would have saw like on TNT or something.
Yeah. So I was kind of feeling it in that way. And they're very entertaining as the trailer trash couple. So
I like him shit talking poor Edna after she left in this trailer. I also think it's funny that Nydia, like, they didn't even give any pretense that they were changing her character. Like she wasn't a redneck on Tough Enough or anything, and now here she is like this. I guess it's really funny, but I guess you're gonna say she fell for Noble, and this is just how it happened. But yeah, they basically go bang in the full size bed. They're great. I've always loved this pairing, and it'll be fun. I mean, they're around for like a year and a half as a team. So
what does he say? He's like, look at this baby running water. No more making trips to the whale.
Incredible. Yeah. He said it takes a minute to warm up, but it'll get warm there. We don't have to go to the whale no more. I love your Jamie Noble impression, by the way, Jake. I love it. I love this group, or I love this duo for sure.
Amazing. So we'll get more of them soon enough. But so now we get the fallout, the true fallout from the Thongathon, which is a bra and panties match that was set up based on the drama. So it's going to be Stacy versus Tori. Tori comes out with the thong trophy that she won. So they start wrestling. We get a lot of cartwheel based counters by Stacy to try and avoid Tori's moves. So one of the major through lines through this match that lasts like 3 minutes is that they constantly go for pin attempts when you can't win with a pin. Mm-hmm. And they even call it out on commentary, like, you're not going to win with that. And I guess they try and cover for him, like, oh, they just want to, like Cole says, like, oh, you can't win with a pin, but nice move. Because they really start doing all these like sunset flip reversal sequences and stuff. But it's really awkward because there's no one to count. So, like, what are they, like, the way they have to get out of is they almost like act like somebody's counting, but they just kind of roll out of it. So that was weird. Stacy hit, I thought, which was a pretty decent spin kick. Yeah, Tori wins by shutout because she basically doesn't lose any clothes and she rips off all of Stacy's clothes. So, and I also love Taz saying, God bless America, the land that I love.
He sings as she's stripping Tori. Because Tori strips anyway after. Yeah. Just rinse repeat for this. I mean, Americana. I give it a quarter star, but Taz singing was the highlight to me. But I mean, both of these girls are just like slamming. I mean, it's like they're like ridiculous at this point. Tori's at the peak of her powers.
Yeah, it's hard to rate as a match. I went half a star, but yeah.
Mainly for Taz Singer.
Yeah, I didn't even rate it because it was just kind of a rolling around and taking off clothes kind of thing. So, but I love that Taz and Cole completely bury the fact that these two girls have no business wrestling, kind of saying that these matches don't take any kind of technique, but these are right up their alley at the same time. So, but yeah, Taz singing was awesome. And Tori stripping is always a good time to have. So,
and we haven't talked like terribly much about Taz and Cole, but I mean, I think their chemistry right away was really strong. I know they've been together for a bit. Taz pretty much has been in the booth since 01, but I mean, I think they're great. I enjoy them so much more than King and JR at this point. Mm-hmm. I mean, JR was great in the ladder match, but beyond that, these guys are just more, they just felt like the younger voices, you know, like I could see how younger fans maybe would connect more with them. As a commentary team, Taz is funny. They're more laid back, but can be focused and serious when need be. It's just a nice pairing. Like, I think they just work. They feed off each other really well. I think Cole ups his game because of Taz. I think Taz helps him along. And I mean, Taz has always been a great talker. So it's like, it's a good use of him. It's a good way to get Cole better. And it's a good mix of serious and the ability to be, you know, comedic like this.
Yeah, and like Taz can do, like, even in that match, he does his, like, you know, he's singing the song because he's excited, they're stripping. So it's like he's still, like, into the women and them being, you know, naked and stuff. But he doesn't come off as, like, a complete creepy perv because he's just like, oh, yeah, look at these hot women. But he's not, like, weirdly, like, into it like Lawler is. And like you said, he's very good at kind of, he can do both. Like, he can get really into the psychology of the match and then pepper in his goofy stuff, too. But, yeah,
well, and it doesn't feel really like good. It doesn't feel like he's, like, objectifying them. It's like,
yeah,
he's just like, they're hot. You know what I mean? Whereas King... And, you know, look, part of it's probably because we know King's, like, real-life personality, so, like, that makes it creepier, right? That he's, like, kind of a lech, so it's, like, it feels weird with him saying it versus Taz, but, yeah, I don't know, it's just different.
Yeah. All right, so off of that, we get some, basically, like, some pregame before our big main event title match. We get a recap of Jeff and Taker's match from Monday that we just spoke about a second ago. And basically, like, could it be a factor in this match? Is Taker going to be worn out from that war with Jeff? Then we get Mark Lloyd with Taker. And Taker says he's not looking past anyone. But next week, the Rock returns, and he's ready for the Rock to get his revenge. And I really like how they're weaving in all these guys into the main event scene right now. It definitely has that feeling of, it sort of has an early 97 feel to me, where like things are definitely in flux. You see a lot of guys, but it's all guys that are huge stars, like Rock, Taker, you know, Triple H is going to be back soon.
Hogan, Angle.
Yeah, you have all these guys, and it's sort of like nobody is really the top dog right now. They're trying to figure out where they want to go with it. You have Brock, who has a title shot at SummerSlam. So it really has a cool vibe, and I really like how, you know, he's going into this match with Angle, but he's still got Rock on his mind. It's cool how they're weaving all of this together. It's really cool. On that, we will go into the actual match. So this is Taker versus Angle for the title. All right, so... this was a match. So we start off, Angle quickly gets frustrated as he can't get the upper hand with his wrestling on Taker versus Taker's physicality, which really was the entire story of this match. It was a lot of Angle trying to, you know, do his sort of wrestling moves where Taker is just a brawler and using his kind of power and physicality. And they did a really good job with that. So finally, Angle's able to get some arm drags, but then he stops to kind of pose and be cocky, which gets him a big boot to the face. He then goes for a takedown, but Taker hits him with a clothesline. So again, Angle's constantly trying to go for takedowns and stuff, but it's not working on Taker. And Angle is just selling like crazy. Everything Taker hits on him just looks great because Angle just attacks the mat so well on everything that Taker does. So all Taker's offense looks great. Angle is finally able to hit a big German to get a little bit of momentum. And so now he's on top. He's trying to ground Taker. He puts him in a front face lock. He starts arguing with the ref at one point about something, which then gives Taker an opening again. And he nails a DDT for a near fall. And like you mentioned, JT, Taz really good here mentioning the classic, like, okay, he didn't hook the leg. You're not going to beat Kurt Angle like that. They continue. Angle then reverses the tombstone to an ankle lock, which is a really awesome spot. Taker's now struggling in the ankle lock, trying to get out of it, but Angle won't let up. He finally swings his foot, which launches Kurt off, and so he gets out of the ankle lock, but then Kurt comes right back and hits an Angle slam, but Taker gets his foot on the rope. Now we get the straps down, so Angle's going into his next gear. He goes back to the ankle lock, but then Taker powers out again and hits a choke slam, and now Taker is really reeling from the ankle lock, and so he delays with the pin after the choke slam, so he can't get the win, so that's a near fall. Angle counters the last ride by wrapping the head and then turning into like a triangle choke. And this spot was fucking sick. I love this so much. How he just turns the last ride into the triangle choke and like slowly drags him down. That was awesome. Taker. So the ending of the match is basically that Taker taps, but Angle's shoulders are down at the same time. So they basically do like sort of a double finish where it's like, did Taker tap out before Angle got counted? Because even though Angle's got the submission, the shoulders are down. And so Cole and Taz are kind of debating it. The refs come out. I was not familiar with this referee, Mike Sparks, Mike Bubba Sparks. He says that Angle got it.
He said there's booty everywhere.
Cordero says, Cordero says that it's Taker, but Mike Chioda was our actual ref, and he basically calls it a draw. So Taker retains the title, and Angle's livid, so he puts the ankle lock on because he's furious. and we kind of closed the show with some controversy as to who should be the champion. JT, what were your thoughts on this one after that very long recap?
I mean, it's a big main event on a loaded show. What a week for Taker. Like, Jeff Hardy had a ladder match, and then this match with Angle a few days later. And Cole questions it. How much does Taker have in the tank? You know, like, and I think that's a cool byproduct of what gets lost with that traveling champion gimmick and what's been so cool about it. Like, he's got to work both shows, so he's going to have weeks like this where he has to have matches against guys and that are going to try him and test him. A lot of power offense from Taker, heavy clotheslines, the Snake Eyes, the boot, like all that stuff looked really good. Both guys are laying everything in. Everything is tight and stiff. The counter from the tombstone to the ankle lock looked great from Angle. Taker, of course, lasts a while in the ankle lock, not a surprise. And then you get the finish with the last ride into the triangle, which looked amazing. And then the kind of, I don't call it dusty finish, but the confusing finish. The crowd does get a little pissy, but it kind of was an end to the mean type of thing. Like, you're lucky you're getting this match probably on a TV taping, so just deal with it. Mm-hmm. And then really adds the suspense for vengeance. But this was a fun match. It was so much good back and forth. Smooth transitions and pacing. It flowed well. And the finish is fine. Both guys look great. I don't know if it's the best match together. Probably their best match to date, considering their stuff in 2000 wasn't that great. But I think more goodness to come from them. And it makes you wonder where they're heading to vengeance with Rock in the mix now and Angle having a claim as well to being deserving another title match. I went 3.25. This is a very strong main event to what's been a great episode of SmackDown.
Yeah, I went 3 on this one. I really like that Taker uses his power offense earlier to kind of frustrate Angle. It obviously pissed him off that everything Angle tried to do, Taker kind of had an answer for, and kind of used some like big shoulder blocks and stuff like that to kind of knock him down and frustrate him. Angle tries to kind of use some of his quickness at certain points, but Taker kind of Jake mentioned it. He kind of hits him with that big boot. After he kind of celebrates a little bit after hitting a few moves. Once Angle kind of gets his full advantage, he takes out his frustrations with some heavy kicks and strikes, and he hits some big suplexes. He hits a German and kind of a back suplex. The reversal that y'all talked about out of the tombstone into the ankle lock, I thought that was amazing. It looked really cool. He kind of wiggled free and went down and locked the ankle lock in. They kept mentioning that Taker had never tapped before this match. I can't imagine that that's true, but I guess I'll believe it for now.
I think it is. I mean, when would he have?
I couldn't think of anything, but I just had to feel like he had to have tapped at some point before this, but maybe not.
I don't think so.
Huh. Yeah, maybe not. The ending was kind of weird to me, but I guess I get it. You don't want to beat either guy really at this point. And a DQ kind of would have probably pissed the crowd off even more. I thought the refs looked more stupid than the competitors, because I thought this was a really solid match, and I thought these guys both looked great. And I know that they can put on an even better match in the future. So I really like this one.
Yeah, I was feeling this one. I actually went 3.75 on it. I really like the way that they used, like I said, when I was recapping it, like the contrast of the two styles and the way they worked that throughout the entire match. Angle looked fantastic in this match, and Taker did too, because he's selling everything. He kind of sold a little bit of exhaustion from Monday. And I didn't really mind the finish that much because to me, it kind of, like I said, they're sort of starting to build up Angle as, you know, put him back in the main event scene. And I feel like this, you know, because if he wins, he's going to get the title. But this basically gives him a reason to be in the main event scene. And so it's a good way to kind of sneak him in there. And then it leaves you, you know, you leave SmackDown wondering, well, now Angle's in the mix. So now we have Rock, Angle, Taker. And it doesn't feel like any of them have been thrown in there. They all feel like they have a purpose for being there, which is cool. And yeah, I just felt like everything in this match, like, served a purpose. Like, every spot seemed to be like nothing seemed wasted. Like how we talked about the ladder match, like there was a stretch that was a little dull. I felt like nothing in this was dull. Like, everything had a purpose, and it wasn't a super long match either. So that they were able to do this in that short of time. Yeah. I thought this was a great match. It was awesome. And, a good cap to a great show. So with that, we'll get to our overall thoughts. I thought this was, man, I don't even know what to rate this one, because it's like how much better of an episode of like SmackDown at this time are you going to get, you know? You have a great main event. Pretty much everything besides, I guess, maybe like the bra and panties match served some type of purpose, built up something, built some guys. You had a new faction, like, established themselves in a cool open. You had the great tag champ moment. I don't know. I think I'm going 8 out of 10 on this one because this was, I mean, this is a great episode. This is easily the best episode of TV I've watched since doing the pod.
Yeah, I went 7.5. I mean, it's crazy because, like I said, that Raw is so memorable. It's crazy. I think there's a show better than it that week, mm-hmm. but there was, and everything had a purpose. It flowed well. It was an easy watch. Cole and Taz are so good on commentary. The main event is great, and it serves a purpose. And yeah, you get the Cena Jericho match. You get Batista dominant and showing up, and you know, yeah, you get the launch of the Team Canada stuff. It's just a fun episode, a damn good episode. That tag title change was awesome. And yeah, it was a really, really fun one to relive. And it's just nuts how overlooked it is and how buried it is in this week.
Yeah, it's definitely a hidden episode of SmackDown. I didn't have any real anticipation going into this one until I kind of looked at the card and honestly watched it. But it's a really great episode of SmackDown. I'll go with JT. I'll give it a 7.5. But yeah, everything at least served a purpose, and some of the matches were really great, and we had a really great moment with the title change and giving Edge and Hogan the belt. So a really, really, really strong effort for SmackDown on this one.
Yeah, it's a great pair of a great week of TV for them. It's weird. They seem Absolutely. To do this a lot. Like, they did it a while back when it was when you had the Eddie Ladder match and then the Cage match. They kind of seem to do this every now and then where they just hit it on both shows. But so now we'll head to our awards. Best match. I had Taker Angle, but I don't know if you guys probably had the ladder match maybe.
I went with the ladder match for sure.
Yeah, me too. It was close call with Angle Taker, mm-hmm. but what a week for Taker, though. I mean, hard to top it.
Yeah, so with that, well, we can go to MVP. I went with Taker just for both those matches. I mean, he's been, like, he had that stinker at King of the Ring, but on TV, mm-hmm. he's been pretty solid.
Mm-hmm. I ended up going with Hardy just because, mm-hmm. like, it was such a star-making moment for him. Like, everyone remembers it. Taker was awesome, too, for the week, but, like, that was just Hardy's night. He owned that whole show. And he was the one that everyone leaves remembering, you know, Taker giving them the respect and all that. So, yeah, it's Hardy for me.
Sean's going to be proud of me. I'm actually going to go with Taker on this one. I would have thought coming in, I would have given it to Hardy, but Taker had two really good, awesome main events this week. So I have to give it to him.
He kind of gets the advantage, I guess, because he gets to be on both shows. But mm-hmm. I guess.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Best moment, I had the tag title win.
Yeah, for sure.
I went with kind of the closing moments of the ladder mm-hmm. match where JR kind of calls and really hypes up Jeff at the end. So I kind of went with that whole like finishing stretch of commentary.
Yeah, totally understandable. Best show, I went with SmackDown, which again, like we've said through the whole thing, is kind of surprising. But
yep, SmackDown.
Yeah, both were strong, but I lean towards SmackDown, definitely. It was a fuller show at the end.
Yeah, and my LVP, I went with Nowinski, not because he was like particularly terrible, but just there weren't honestly a lot of people I found that had weak performances on these, so I had to find somebody. So I went with Nowinski.
No, there was one guy that looked like the biggest loser across the show. No, Big Show. Big Show. He looked like such a goof throughout all of Raw. And to me, like, on a week where they did a nice job making a lot of people look strong, yeah, I mean, Bubba's annoying, but he looked good. Like, because he won that match. Sure. So like guys have looked strong on both shows. Like it was a good week for booking, honestly. It was kind of a tumultuous time, but Big Show looked like the biggest goof multiple times between the Goldust hitting him in the head with the lightsaber.
Yeah.
And then Nash calling him a bitch. And then Nash smacking him losing stupid that count out to Booker. And then ending it with Sean stupid kicking him after faking him out. Like he just looked like such a clown on that whole show.
Yeah, Big Show is a good one for sure. I'm going to live my Highway to the Impact Zone gimmick up, and I'm going to give it to Mike Chioda in the main event for just looking clueless after the match was over. So I got to give it to the referee. Got to live the gimmick.
Gonna let Mike Sparks boss you around, Chioda?
No, definitely not. I may just give it to all three referees for acting like a bunch of clueless morons at the end of the show there. So
Logan hates refs.
I hate refs.
Anyway, top five performers. This was kind of tough because you could have picked like a ton of guys, but I went Angle, Taker, Hardy, Edge, and then I kind of cheated and went Booker T and Goldust because they were entertaining on Raw.
Man, it's funny because like I'm not really kind of close. I got a couple crossover, but yeah, all yours sound good to me. But I went Undertaker, Hardy, like those are locks, right? They had to be there. I went Flair. I just really looked really good in that match of Brock, and like it was kind of a cool respect match, and I don't know, I just really enjoyed him in there. I went Lance Storm, who I thought had the promo of his life and was a big step up, and then I kind of cheated. I went Hogan and Edge as the team, which had a great moment. So Angle's the one that feels left out. Like maybe I'd put him in over Flair. Flair's kind of the fifth guy for me on that list, but those are the five guys I really enjoyed the most. And yeah, I mean Booker and Goldust is another good one. So it was a strong week.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. My only difference from you, Jake, is I put Hogan instead of Booker T and Goldust. I went with your other four, definitely. I thought those were the strongest performers. And back to my LVP vote, it was more of an indictment of how great the shows were. Nobody really stood out to me, so that's kind of why I gave it to the referees.
Yeah, you could easily do a top 10 for this week. Easily.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, we did it, boys. We covered both of these. Good stuff. JT, you want to plug our North South feed?
Yeah, I mean, there's tons of stuff going on, obviously, at least 5 to 6 days a week across the worlds of wrestling, pop culture, and some sports with this week in the NFL that drops weekly as well. So just check it all out. Whether you're looking for TNA, ECW, Monday Night Wars era, this era, Ruthless Aggression, list-based stuff, like we have it all. We got some cool stuff coming as well in 2021, a couple new shows debuting that we're really looking forward to. So subscribe on any podcatcher app, North South Connection, facebook.com/North South Connection, and JT the Pod Guy on Twitter. And also be sure to join up on our Place to Be Facebook group page. It's a lot of fun. Some good discussions, some polls, tournaments, all kinds of stuff going on there. Just message us, reach out to be added, or search facebook.com/group/Place to Be. It's been a lot of fun since the last kind of 6 weeks or so since we rebooted it.
Good. Logan, you want to tell them about Highway to the Impact Zone?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to be recording the next episode this coming week. It's going to be the 13th episode of Impact, and we're going to look at the next to last weekly pay-per-view. So we're almost out of the weekly pay-per-views. So that'll be weekly pay-per-view number 110. And they're kind of still building towards the Jeff Hardy, Jeff Jarrett match.
Spoilers. I'm only on episode 721 of TNA.
I say you have 100 to go. You'll forget by the time you get there. But they're really kind of in a holding pattern at this point, kind of building to that last weekly pay-per-view. So it'll be an interesting shows, a couple of interesting shows to look at. But that one's the big one that they're building towards. And we actually recorded the newest episode of Chicken Salad last night. We looked at Starrcade 1989. So Sean Kidd was right in his wheelhouse on that one. So he waxed poetic about the time period. And we actually gave a lot of praise to Lex Luger. So definitely look out for that one in the coming weeks.
Now you're talking. Now you're making chicken salad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good. I think we all made ourselves famous on this show. But I don't know about you guys, but I have a new trailer that I need to go check out. So we're going to have to wrap this up. Thank both of you guys for coming on. Thank JT for putting us over and give us the pat in the head like Undertaker did to Jeff Hardy. But this has been another episode of the Ruthlessly Aggressive Podcast. Please follow along as we head through the summer of 02. It's going to get good. So that's it. Bye-bye.
Later, Star Wars nerds.
I ain't no Star Wars geek. Insanity, the aurora is rising behind us. This beer lights a carnival life forever. Oh, love me tonight, for I may never see you again. Hey,
the greasers. Oh, they tramp the streets or get busted for sleeping on the beach all night. Them boys in their high heels. Ah, oh, Sandy, the skins are so white. And me, I just got tired of hanging in them dusty arcades, banging them pleasure machines, chasing the factory girls underneath the boardwalk, where they all promise to unsnap her jeans. You know that tilt-a-whirl down on the South Beach drag? I got on it last night and my shirt got caught, and it kept me spinning, bitch. Didn't think I'd ever get off. Ooh, Sandy, the world is rising behind us. The spirit lights a carnival life on the water. Running left and meet the boardwalk, all with the boss's daughter. That waitress I was seeing lost her desire for me. I spoke with her last night. She said she won't set herself on fire for me anymore. She worked that joint under the boardwalk. She was always a girl you saw bopping down the beach with the radio. The kids say last night she was dressed like a star in one of them cheap little seaside bars. And I saw her parked with Loverboy out on the Kokomo. Did you hear the cops finally busted Madame Marie for telling fortunes better than they do? For me, this boardwalk life's through, babe. You oughta quit this scene too. Yeah.